Senate will please come to order. You're out of order. Messages from the House.
February the 26th, 2008, from the House of Representatives. Message, third reading, pass. Mr. President, the bills listed below pass the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 51, Multiple Special Handicap License Plates, ayes 60. House Bill number 69, Revisers Bill, ayes 60. House Bill number 106, Sheep Feedlot Exportation Permit, ayes 44, noes 16. House Bill number 107, Property Tax Relief 2, ayes 60. House Bill number 130, Establishment of Public Roads, ayes 60. House Bill number 142, Driver Services Fees 2, ayes 39, noes 21. House Joint Resolution 1, Initiative and Referendum Requirements, ayes 56, noes 4. February the 26th, 2008, from the House of Representatives, message, third reading, passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below pass the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill number 42, Constituent Service Allowance, ayes 60. House Bill number 75, Legislative Per Diem, ayes 60. House Bill number 108, Railroad Quiet Zones, ayes 53, noes 7. House Bill number 169, Contracts for Public Improvements, Bid Requirements, ayes 57, noes 2, conflict 1. House Bill number 117, Developmental Preschool Funding, ayes 57, noes 3. House Bill number 118, Loss of Chance Doctrines Abrogated, ayes 54, noes 6. House Bill number 127, Prescription Drugs Physician Shopping, ayes 57, noes 3. House Bill number 135, Fuel Disclosure, ayes 60. House Bill number 136, Dyed Fuel Enforcement, ayes 47, noes 13. And House Bill number 155, Recruitment of Physicians and Dentists, ayes 45, noes 13, conflict 2. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Here they come. House bills on first reading. House Joint Resolution 1, first reading of the Joint Resolution.
House Joint Resolution 1, Initiative and Referendum Requirements, sponsored by Representative Brown, a joint resolution proposing to amend the Wyoming Constitution to modify the signature requirement for a petition for initiative or referendum. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 56, noes 4.
House Joint Resolution number 1 is assigned to Committee number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 107, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill number 107, Property Tax Relief 2, sponsored by Representative Anderson, and Acts Relating to Taxation and Revenue. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 60.
House Bill 107 is assigned to Committee number 3, Revenue. House Bill 106, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill number 106, Sheep Feedlot Exportation Permit, sponsored by Representative Anderson, and Act relating to brands. It's passed the House on third reading, ayes 44, noes 16.
House Bill 106 is assigned to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. House Bill 51, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 51, Multiple Special Handicap License Plates, sponsored by Representative Edwards, an act relating to motor vehicle registration. Passed the House on third reading, ayes 60.
House Bill 51 is assigned to Committee Number 8, Transportation. House Bill 142, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 142, Driver's Service Fees Number 2, sponsored by Representative Edwards, and Act relating to driver services. Passed the House on third reading, ayes 39, noes 21.
House Bill 142 is assigned to Committee 8, Transportation. House Bill 69, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill number 69, Revisors Bill, sponsored by the Management Council, an act relating to a revision of inadvertent errors. Passed the House on third reading, ayes 60.
House Bill 69 is assigned to Committee number 12, Rules. Standing committee reports.
February the 26th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 6, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Job, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Case. I'm sorry, if we're still reading committee reports, I'll wait. I have a re-referral at the appropriate time.
Okay.
Mr. President, there was a committee report from committee number 7 this morning. It's House Bill 3 engrossed, campaign finance reporting electronic filing. Does contain a little tiny $2.5 million appropriations, and I thought maybe the Appropriations Committee might want to look at that.
Barring any objection, House Bill 3 engrossed is re-referred for the appropriation to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. I can't see what it is. Oh, yeah, let's. Dick, could we go ahead with it? Is that another standing committee report?
Your committee number 2, Appropriations, reviewed House Bill 1 pursuant to Joint Rule 14-1, little e, I, and 2. The following lists are provided, dispensing with further reading. Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
In accordance with Joint Rule 14-1F, subparagraph 1, House Bill number 1 is referred directly to third reading. House Bill 1, third reading of the House Bill.
Dick, I think you have to raise the hand.
House Bill 1, General Government Appropriations, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee, an act to make appropriations for the biennium commencing July 1st, 2008, ending June 30th, 2010.
Okay, members of the Senate, in accordance with our Rule 14-1, we've gone directly to third reading. At this point, I'll ask the Appropriations Committee Chair to walk us through the action of the House on the appropriations bill, and then we'll refer it directly to a conference committee. But we need to know what the differences are, and then they'll go show the House there of their ways. Senator Nicholas, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. President. The first of all, folks, on the golden rod that you have, you'll see that the Senate is above water, $400,000. And the House, those big spenders, are below water in the negative, about $1 million. And that's with the with all of the actions taken as of today. For you've been handed out, and for those, it may be in your amendments file, the documents to go over the mirror amendments as well as the differences. You have a two-sheet page, which we call the cheat sheet. And if you're interested in looking at the amendments, they're going to be found in the adopted House amendments package. You've also got a package for the adopted Senate amendments. On the cheat sheet, the top items on the page which do not have the lines, those represent the identical amendments. Now, when you get into the non-identical amendments, you're going to find that there are a few that appear to be identical, but there are subtle differences, so they'll have to fall down in below. But in the identical amendment package are the following. The first one, which was the House Second Reading Amendment number 2, both houses added in the $351,685 for the 1% retiree insurance program for the judicial branch. That's a mirror amendment. Both houses put an effective immediately on the $3.7 million general fund appropriation to the state parks for the roads. Both parties added $30,000 to the Department of Health budget for the long-term care home pilot program. Both houses put a cleanup amendment on UW academic facilities match and amounts from the last session. You recall that's the one that dropped some facilities matches, added, or didn't add any, but the dropped some and rearranged the dollars. Both houses allocated $1 million of the $33.4 million of SLIV funds. Those are the mineral royalty grant dollars for unfunded capital projects for energy audits. Both of the houses provided the $366,000 out of the retirement system of their dollars to employ a chief investment officer. Both houses put on the amendment that allowed $3 million of the $4 million set aside for the state hospital for emergency detentions. To $3 million of that to be used for a crisis stabilization program, with $4.4 million of federal funds to be used to expand the crisis stabilization. So that's essentially the matching component. Both houses agreed to the $1.8 million clean coal technology account for the projects. You recall those are dollars already in the budget. We essentially authorized the expenditure and clarified that the $3.8 million in AML funding be available later for future appropriation by the board. We removed the four, both houses agreed to remove the WICHE medical students repayment requirement that would have mirrored that program to the WAMI program. That footnote removed both houses. Both houses added $317,000 to the Division of Administration Information for the GIS AWAC employee to begin preparation for the 2010 census. which ties directly to our redistricting. Both houses agreed to the GAL language change. That's the change that provided that the public defender would have more authority over allocating dollars rather than the county having some direct, takes some of the oversight from the county, puts it into the public defender program, who will be administering the dollars. The both houses agreed to the footnote to increase Medicaid reimbursement for obstetrics, prenatal care. You recall that took those programs up to 100% reimbursement. The money was already in the budget. Both houses agreed to add the $135,000 to the Legislative Service Office budget, establishing the Community College Task Force. That is actually the task force statute or the implementation along with the appropriation. And both houses agreed to add $2 million of general fund of existing Department of Family Services funding to be used for that Community Juvenile Services Boards. So those are the mirror amendments. They're off the board for the first conference. And now we go down below to the non-mirror amendments. Now, if you have your adopted House amendments package, if there's if you have an interest in them, I'll give you the page numbers as I'm going through where you'll see the actual language. In many instances, there it's language that you may already be familiar with because amendments were tried on both sides of the House. The first item is a footnote establishing the Wyoming Public TV endowment requirements. Those requirements are found on beginning on page one of the House amendments, and they go over to page two. We actually, the endowment monies were already in, but we did not have a vehicle to implement the endowment match, so the language implementing it was insufficient. No mirror amendment was provided on the House or on the Senate side, but I think generally we will have to agree there. Generally it does require an endowment implementation language. The next item changes the base amount of direct distributions to towns from $10,000 to $20,000. That item, it was later deleted, but it was the first attempt at amending their cities, towns, and counties distribution, the local government distribution, but it's really not relevant because it was deleted. The next item, the $15,000 general fund for incidental expenditures for the statewide officials, they didn't have a Senator Coe over there actually making additions, and they didn't realize that it was $30,000. And so they're $15,000 light to implement that program. The next item is a footnote allowing the tribes to participate in the community facilities program. That was proposed here. That language, when you go back and look at their adopted language, has the same defect here. It does not have an appropriation in it. There's no authorization to spend. So same language we've seen. The next footnote is to the Department of Transportation General Fund Appropriation, providing that the $200 million that we have in for roads will not return as a standard budget item. That's an interesting thing because here's the issue, folks. If you put it in the standard budget, we know where it is. You can take it out. But what it means is that after the CREG comes out with their estimates, then the first issue has, you ask yourselves is how much surplus or how much revenues above the CREG estimates are available for expenditure. And if it's in your standard budget, it shows your budget's here and you have X amount of surplus. Well, if it's not in there, then the surplus looks $200 million heavier, and immediately you have constituents saying, well, there's $200 million for us. We know where the money is. We can always take it out if we run short of money. But there is some advantage to having it in the in the general fund just so that when, after the CREG meets, the report meets and the governor goes to fix his budget, constituents can see that there is built in, or they see the surplus, and the surplus looks smaller, and the expectations aren't as high. There's about $180 million, I think, now built in for cities, towns, and counties. So if you take it out of the general fund, or excuse me, you take it out of the budget, out of the standard budget, all that will happen is you'll have a higher reported surplus. Interesting problem. We'll address it in the conference. Funding for a site, the next item was funding for site acquisition for the development cost of the travel center south of Cheyenne. That was the $652,000. That amendment failed on this side. I think everybody knows what that issue is about. They adopted the footnote earmarking $3.2 million for the Casper Residential Treatment Center. You'll see one amendment here where and then you'll see later on they came back and tweaked it some more to try to make sure that funding did not stop or that it wouldn't that it would get wrapped into the standard budget. You'll see that in a minute. That's at page 8 if you're interested in it. They added $1 million for the railroad quiet zones. You're familiar with that because that failed on this side. They added $500,000 for various state fair capital construction project inflationary costs. That's at page 15 of the package if you want to look at it. You'll see what they've done is we had an amendment that allowed the state fairs, the Department of Agriculture, to use the what looked to be sort of reversions and to continue using them for capital facilities. They came back, convinced the House that, one, they needed that footnote deleted because those dollars are going to be expended, they're already committed, and they needed another $500,000 to complete the projects that we have already appropriated for but have not gotten started, and there's an inflationary cost. So the House accepted that argument, gave them another $500,000 to complete those projects, and backed out footnote that we left in on this side. The next item, the $75,000 for the feasibility of the, that's the PAWS growth model system. In this amendment, they put in $75,000 additional funding. You'll see just below, they came back and took out the $75,000 but kept the PAWS growth model system in, the requirement in. The next item is the $4.5 million AML for the Bitter Creek cleanup project. They did the same thing that we did. They came in with a broad amendment that took it right out of the $30 million commitment for AML dollars. For ongoing projects, they came back and did this essentially the same amendment that we did, which then took the money out of reversions of projects that are ongoing. But just because of the nature of those two actions, while they're virtually identical, they are listed as non-identical because of multiple amendments. The next item is a footnote. If you want to take a look at this language, it's on page 17 of your packet. The House adopted a footnote requiring that the Wildlife Trust Fund Board require scientific support for any projects that are approved before they're funded. Again, look at page 17 if you want to see the detail of that language. Page 18 of the package is a footnote adopted that eliminated the requirement for a match for the historical context development. That's an amendment that failed on our side. You should be familiar with it. The next item is at page 18 through 19 of the package. This is those reversions of $1.8 million that were identified by the university. You recall that we use the reversions to further fund the hospital, the library endowment. The House adopted an amendment that was defeated on this side to use those resources for develop a level of expertise in uranium and nuclear projects. The next item is the House deleted the next item is what I already described. That's for the $75,000 of additional school foundation dollars. was eliminated, but it maintained the language requiring that the department implement or take a look at that growth model system. The next amendment added a carryover section for UW School of Energy Research. Actually, that carryover language is adopted on our side, but for a technical reason, it's reflected as a non-mere amendment. The House added language to allow special districts to receive block grant monies. So these are the consensus block grant monies. I had actually thought that we had it in the language came in out of the JAC. They caught it. It was not in there, so they've added that language, expanding the scope of who can apply or participate in the consensus block grants. The Wildlife Trust Challenge Fund, you'll recall we've made it in a prior legislative action. We set aside and appropriated $3.2 million to the Wildlife Trust Fund that was only available for matching matches. That matching program expires on at the end of 2008, so the House identified that, extended the matching program for another 2 years, and apparently they're advised that they think that those dollars are going to be matched. The next item I've already talked about, that's removes the carryover for the state fair. Their CAPCON funds are already available for expenditure until the project is completed. We'll have to sort those items out. The next footnote over is clarifying the DOC funds. This is the Casper facility. Those dollars will be included in the 2011-2012 standard budget. So not only did they get the amendment on that was rejected here, but they got them to extend it for another 2 years. The next item is language restricting use of any of the 100 series for anything other than 100 series. By way of explanation, remember the 100 series are your salaries. And every agency has salaries. In the statute, there is provision that says agencies can only use their 100 series dollars for salaries. They can't flex those into other programs within their budget to, for example, the 900 series for contracts. So you can't say, well, I'm not going to hire 10 employees and I'm going to take the money to go out and contract it or flex it out. Because of our flex language in our budget, that overrides the statutory restriction on the 100 series. What this does is implements that 100 series or imposes that restriction back into our budget. Frankly, I think it's probably okay except in the area of corrections. In the corrections, we've been allowing the Department of Corrections to B11 flex out their 100 series because they have so many vacancies in Rawlins. We've been allowing them to use those monies to use for recruitment and setting up apartments to get folks. So we'll have to, other than the corrections, I don't think it has a big impact, and it may be a positive thing. Before last summer, this is something that A&I could not even track, but they've now implemented a new computer system where they can now track within the series funds. So we'll talk about that. The next footnote is the same one that was adopted here, but for technical reasons we have to choose one or the other. That's the footnote requiring the DOD district engineers to confer with county commissioners for their future plans. You want to look at their language, it's page 25 of the handout. The next item is a footnote. They actually adopted the footnote requiring that $48,000 of federal funds be in the Department of Family Services be used for the Father Factor Program amendment that failed on this side, although I don't remember if it came out of federal funds or general funds here, but anyway, that made it to it. The next item is deleted the previous AML language for Bitter Creek and provided that the new $4.5 million has come out of the reversions. The next item, they did adopt an amendment for $200,000 in the governor's office to study the state's employment medical services system. Going to the next page, the next two amendments address the local government funding, and I'll come back to that in a minute. The second from the bottom language, they went back into the quiet zone language for the railroad quiet zones that recall $1 million and changed that to provide for a match instead of just an outright grant. And then finally they added $100,000 for landscaping for the governor's mansion. That's the same as our action. However, it for technical reasons, it requires action to be taken as a non-mirror amendment. Now, if you take a look at the handout that just came out as I began speaking to you, that is a spreadsheet that shows the differences between the House and the Senate position as it affects local governments. The principal differences between the House and the Senate are as follows. The House agreed to implement and use $40 million for the replacement or to be allocated on the sales tax model. We've been calling the Department of Revenue sales tax replacement model that holds everybody harmless. That was $40 million. They adopted that amendment. They took the entire $40 million out of the consensus block grant program. So what we did, you recall, is we took $22 million out of the consensus block dollars, put them over, and added them to the county distributions. So in some ways, it's hard to compare. If I were to, so that's one difference. The second difference is they did employ the second year distribution for counties. Our model has the first year. So if you go back to last bienniums, our model as it stands today is the distribution we adopted at the beginning of the biennium. The county adopted the House adopted the county's model at, which is the second year of the biennium last year. The counties do prefer the House position on that for the second year. Finally, with respect to the county block distribution, these are the consensus dollars. They adopted a $1.8 million base. And then everything above it is what we described as the R6 model, which is a model based upon the inverse ratio of assessed valuation throughout the state. If you were to go back and look at our comparators, where recall we had JAC position, we had alternative 3, 4, and 5, the county's position or the House position is most like alternative 3, except that two things. One is they took more money. In alternative 3, we distributed the cost of the $40 million, we distributed half to consensus, half to direct. They distributed all to or took it all out of the consensus distribution. And in alternative 3, there's not a $1.8 million base. If you look at the winners and the losers, if you compare ours to the, you compare the Senate position to the House, the real losers look to me to be the big population areas. Natrona loses about $4 million overall. There's about $3 million lost through Laramie County. Teton County loses about $2 million. I'm not certain yet. We will further try to identify what the why that reduction occurs, but I think that it may be the $1.8 million base, because the $1.8 million base ensures that the smaller counties get more, leaving less for distribution on a population basis. So anytime you have a base, it favors smaller counties to the larger counties, but I'm not certain of that. To make things a little bit more complicated, and I would take Natrona County as an example. Even though they lose $4 million approximately, on the whole, the city of Senate position is $4 million more generous to Natrona County. The city of Casper benefits under the House position because the city of Casper gets more while the county gets less. So we have those sort of interesting nuances, and you may be finding that the city of Casper wants a position that doesn't seem appropriate for the county, but that's why. We'll be sorting through those. Mr. President, I'd stand for questions. Otherwise, everything's been explained.
Questions regarding the differences or the similarities in House Bill 1, the House position as compared to the Senate position. Senator Scott.
Mr. President, question on the conference committee procedure. You get an issue like the cities and counties, you can compromise that anywhere between the two houses, can you not? And what I'm specifically wondering is if somebody proposed, well, we'll distribute half the money on the House formula and half the money on the Senate formula. That would be a compromise that would fall within the differences in the houses and be feasible in the first conference committee, would it not?
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. President, I've been thinking about that, and I mean, you can probably interpret the rules in two ways. One is you say, look at the raw numbers, the final numbers, and you have to work within those numbers so that in a real sense, no community should fall outside of those real numbers. Or you can look at the underlying formula. And you could say, this is your formula, and this is your formula, and you can mix and match formulas. If you mix and match formulas, you may find some or maybe 80% of the communities fall within the range, but one or two may fall outside the range of dollars. So we have to pay attention to both of those. But it does occur to me that as a practical, in order to avoid the criticism that we're engaged in special legislation where we appropriate to a single community, the final result should be based upon some formula. So I think the conferees should pay attention to the formulas and adopt a formula which reaches a position between the two houses, even though individual communities may find themselves on the either out, but it's probably more important to have a formula. Well, I wouldn't say that. It's just as important to have a formula administer the dollars as it is to make sure that you're within the parameters on a given city, for example, within the House position and the Senate position. Does that make sense? No, it doesn't.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, what I was asking is a little different. I hear that we need to have a formula, and that makes sense. What I'm suggesting is that you could have not one formula, but two, and distribute half the money on each one. Now, one formula is the Senate version, one formula is the House version. If you compromise it that way, you do always wind up within the difference between the houses.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. President, I agree you can do that. I hadn't given a thought. Well, our bill would be twice as long, and we just have to profile, but that's something we should take a look at. That's actually an interesting way to do it. So we'll consider that, or whoever the conferee is.
Further questions? In accordance with Joint Rule 14-1, subparagraph G, and Joint Rule 14-1, subparagraphs H, 1, and 2, House Bill 1 is referred directly to a conference committee of five members from each House to meet to resolve the differences between the houses with respect to both budget bills, Senate File 1 and House Bill 1. On the Budget Conference Committee will be Senator Nicholas, Senator Meyer, Senator Peterson, Senator Townsend, and Senator Job. Senator Meyer.
Mr. President, may I have the privilege of the floor? The
floor is yours, Senator.
Mr. President, last year the Prince of Pork Award went to a member here in the Senate, and the good senator from Cheyenne. However, he has sent it back to me with this note, Mr. Chairman, that perhaps because the Senate was in the black and the House was in the red, that this beautiful representation of overspending and just too much porkerosity should go down to the House. And so, Mr. President, with your blessing, I would move and would hope that you would consider endorsing this fine little representation of porkerosity to reside at the House.
Hearing no objection, I hope you will deliver that personally to the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. I see his head is already hanging now, and this will give him the lift he needs to go into negotiations.
I can't think of a better way to deliver it, and we'll deliver it as the first item of business in the conference committee.
Senator Burns.
Mr. President, may I have privilege of the floor, please?
The floor is yours, sir.
Mr. President, we are, and I feel honored to have down here visiting the 2008 class of Leadership Sheridan. They are up in the south balcony, and I wish you'd make them welcome.
Welcome and enjoy your stay in the Capitol. Senator Von Flader.
I have privilege of the floor, please.
The floor is yours, sir.
Thank you, Mr. President. In the opposite side of the House, Senate, I would like the Senate to please welcome the class of 2008 Gillette Area Leadership, which I am a graduate of probably 18 years ago. So please welcome them in the Senate.
Welcome. Welcome to the Senate.
Yeah, their hope is they do better.
Members of the Senate, keep in mind, this afternoon, the representative from NCSL will be out in the lobby. If you want to visit with her, she is available. Consideration of bills on general file. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. President, I move the Senate resolve itself into the Committee of the Whole.
The motion is that the Senate resolve itself into Committee of the Whole. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. We're in Committee of the Whole. Okay. I'm going to take these.
Will the Committee of the Whole please come to order? We are back on House Bill 89, and it would be Committee of the Whole Amendment 1. Would the reading clerk please read in the amendment?
House Bill 89, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to engrossed copy, page 1, line 16.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I just want to, after this almost two-hour and 45-minute break dealing with this bill, I would like to start out by stating the importance of this bill. Regardless of the amendments that go on, I think this is a very important bill. I think it's a groundbreaking bill in many ways, and it could end up being one additional spice in the recipe that provides long-term financial health for the state of Wyoming. Mr. Chairman, that being said, one of the aspects of this
Senator
bill...
Senator Burns, do you want to move the amendment?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 89.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this bill breaks some ground in terms of law frankly. What it does is it takes the property rights bundle, pulls another stick out of that bundle, one that has never been recognized before, and that of poor spaces. Now, when you look at that, one of the other aspects of that is that is provided in the bill is it makes that particular aspect of property ownership to be severable. If you go down to, it starts on page 2, line 9, I'm sorry, right at the end of line 8, line 9, no agreement conveying material or other interest underlying the surface shall act to convey ownership of any poor space in the stratum unless the agreement explicitly conveys that ownership interest. Mr. Chairman, as we remember, the poor space has been attached to the surface ownership by this bill. What this bill does also is allows the owner of the surface estate to get rid of, either sell off or by any other means, inheritance or whatever, to sever off the poor space from the surface estate. What that does, Mr. Chairman, is it creates a third estate. We have the surface estate, we have the mineral estate, now we have the poor space estate. Mr. Chairman, this is a huge step. It is a huge step. And it raises a number of questions that are not answered by this bill. And that's what concerns me, and that's the reason for this amendment. Mr. Chairman, some of the questions we have, or that I just came up with in a matter of minutes on this. The poor space, if it's separated off from the surface estate and from the mineral estate, is it divisible? I think it is. As a matter of fact, it has to be. So, for instance, I have a ranch, I have a surface estate, I separated off the poor space estate, I die, I've got 5 sons. And I leave the ranch to them as a tenancy in common. Divided. So now the poor space estate is divided 5 ways. This happens with the mineral estate. We've seen this happen over generations, especially up in my part of the state where private property ownership and the mineral estate with it has been around for 100 years. And we see, you see it in Campbell County, you see it in Sheridan County, and I'm sure in Johnson County and a number of other county clerks' vaults. There are landmen who spend all day just trying to track down the mineral ownership of particular pieces of property. So those 5 sons then have 5 sons. Now you've split this estate up 25 ways and in only 3 generations. The 4th generation, let's say they each have 5 sons. Now you've gone to 125 splits. We've already seen this in the mineral estate. That's the first concern. The second concern I have, or question I have about this, again, is it divisive, but using the term in another way. We've got different poor spaces underneath the ground. So when I sever and sell off the poor space, am I selling all the poor spaces, or can I just sell one poor space that's maybe 500 feet underground or 5,000 feet underground, and another one 13,000 feet underground? So can it be divided that way? We don't know. We don't know the answer to that question. Another question, Mr. Chairman, again not answered by this bill. Which estate's dominant? We already know that the mineral estate, and it's explicitly stated in here, that the mineral estate stays dominant. No question there. But is the poor space estate the second estate or the third estate? What is dominant to the other? And each one brings its own set of problems. If you make the surface estate dominant to the poor space estate, then how does the poor space estate owner get to their poor space? If you make the poor space estate dominant to the surface estate, you're running into some of the same problems with split estate that we've already had to deal with. And I don't know if that's covered. Mr. Chairman, and another question that comes up, is it condemnable? Now, Mr. Chairman, one of the things that we know we're going to be doing in Judiciary Committee is we're going to further study this question of poor space. We're going to question the idea of is it condemnable? Is it a subject to eminent domain. We don't know. And, Mr. Chairman, that's why I brought this amendment. What this amendment does is it states that the poor estate, the poor space estate, is not severable from the surface estate. It follows with it. I don't know if it should always stay like that or not, but, Mr. Chairman, for our purposes, until we can get some of the answers to some of these questions, and we have to study, I think, this issue, because it is so groundbreaking, I propose this amendment go into this bill and also become subject to the study, interim study, by the Judiciary Committee about this subject and about this topic. We can always come next year and say, yes, it should be severed, and I may be leading the charge on that. I don't know. The problem I have right now is there are too many unanswered questions that happen when you sever the porous estate from the surface estate. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion on Committee of the Whole 1. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we, that was, all of those issues were discussed and they're resolved in this bill. First, you have to remember that to the extent that there are pores, spaces below your ground, and you as a surface owner own those pores, they're a property right. And the right now, we do not restrict a property rights owner to sever parts of a state. You can lease parts and sever them. And this bill does provide that you can sever if you choose to, and you could sell off your pore space. You have the right to do that. You have the right, if you own the mineral estate and the surface estate, you as a property owner have the right to sever your interest and sell off and receive income from, and if you want, choose to keep that income from the lower stratas. Is it divisible? Absolutely. The pore space is divisible, just like property rights, or just like the surface rights, just like the mineral rights, just like any other rights. Can you sell off stratums? Absolutely. You could say you're entitled to, I'll lease to you the pore space from 0 to 50 feet below the surface, but below that, you absolutely, I'm not going to sell it to you. You can do whatever you want. They're your property rights. With respect to the dominance, because these are new interests that we really haven't thought about, over time, there's no body of law that defines that. So we address that on page 3, lines 13 through 17. And there what we say is that all instruments which transfer the rights to pore space under the section shall describe the scope of any right to use the surface estate. The owner of the pore space shall have no right to use the surface estate beyond that set out in a properly recorded instrument. So what we've done is resolve the issue to say, look, you get exactly what's in your original instrument. If you don't specify, then you don't get any surface rights. Some of these salt domes might cover 4 or 5 sections, and it might be that you say, look, I'll give you the pore space, but you cannot run equipment over on top or put injection points on my property. But that will be negotiated at the time of the purchase. Then the instrument that defines that will be in record so everybody's on notice so you know what you're selling. And so that addresses the issue with respect to the dominance. We've resolved that with much debate and came up with what we thought was a good solution. With respect to condemnation, condemnation is a power that you only have by grant. It's a power that belongs to the state of Wyoming. And except by grant of the state, no private party can undertake condemnation. At this point, there is no statute authorizing anybody to condemn this pore space. That was a topic, whether or not we're going to have to grant that right, we may have to make this effective in the future. Because if you want to go out and store under a large salt dome with multiple owners, you may find that there's a holdout and you may need some mechanism, but that provision, there is no power at this time, and that is left subject for future debate. So for all those reasons, I would urge that you defeat the amendment.
Further discussion. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against the amendment, ladies and gentlemen. This is, I understand the good senator's intentions in bringing this amendment. It was also brought during the committee yesterday, and it was defeated 4-1. It was defeated because what we are doing is codifying the common law. We're allowing individuals to have the property rights that they have always had. Part of that right is the right to do with your property as you see fit. For many, many years, we've allowed property owners to sever their or sell their mineral interests. We are now defining for you that they own, and we're making it explicit, that they own the substrata. We believe that that is already the common law and already the law, but we are codifying that at this point in time. And I suggest to you that it's bad public policy for us as a legislature to tell any landowner what they can or cannot do with their property. It is their right to alienate part of that property if they so desire. It is their right to retain it if they so desire. It is not a problem, folks, if they don't want to sell this property right. And they have every option, and they are very astute now. We've been through split estates. We've been through all of that. They are astute, and they know what they can or can't do with their own property, and we shouldn't be telling them what to do with that. We heard some very, very eloquent speakers with regards to this issue in committee. And one of them was the Director of State Lands, who, not only being a lawyer, was a property law expert, who testified that if you don't allow the severability, you may very well be facing constitutional issues concerning takings. The issue concerning condemnation is an issue for another day, and it may never even come to pass. It may be that we go similar to what's done in the oil and gas area with regards to pooling. Regardless, the landowner at this point in time will have the same bundle of sticks, the same rights that they've had with all of their property, and I submit to you that as well-intentioned as this amendment is, it is not our place as a legislature to dictate what somebody can do with their property or tell somebody else what to do with their property next to them. I'd urge your defeat of the amendment.
Further discussion, Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to have some clarification from the committee on this amendment. If we pass the amendment, then we tie everything to the surface. If we don't pass the amendment and we leave it the way it is, then you can sever it and sell it. But what we haven't talked about that I can remember at all is what about misuse of that pore space and the liability that would come with it? If we sever it and sell it, does it have to be in the contract that the liability goes with the severance? Or is that something else we're going to address another day? I just like a little bit more talk on the liability, how it's affected to this amendment. Does it go back and forth or stay or however you want to answer it? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, and we appreciate those questions. There was discussion in the committee about that, and once again, the law, this amendment would change the common law as it is right now. And so, but specifically back to your question with respect to liability, one of the issues that mitigates or militates in favor of severability is in the event that ultimately this ends up being carbon, you end up sequestering carbon dioxide in one of these things, or there's other types of storage that happens in those, there may be liabilities that attach. Such as we've seen with CERCLA, RCRA, those types of federal liabilities where they go back and they find each person in the chain of title who had anything to do with putting any of the kind of the pollutants in there. The RCRA is the kind of the clean water and the CERCLA is this kind of Superfund sites. And ultimately that's one of the things that would kind of you'd think might be in favor of severability is that once you sever that and you're out of the chain of title, then that liability would go with the owner of those poor spaces who's putting whatever it is in the ground that gives rise to that kind of liability. So there's a liability that arises there. But going back, again, as looking at, again, as a surface estate owner, it's still subject to, if you're worried about contamination or destruction of your ability or pushing out minerals or other things like that, that you've got those rights. You already have those rights. Those are dominant. And if there's actions taken that infringe or trespass upon your rights and your ability to develop your minerals, then you're going to be subject to liability and damages associated with that trespass or with that action that interferes with your ability to develop your minerals. I think that's what the law is now, and that shouldn't change.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a little bit more pull on the question. If we leave it the way it is to where it can be severed, and the liability right now is with whoever puts whatever they put in there, if it can be severed, then in the future, can that liability be transferred to the state or to the federal government because the person who has it and it's severable couldn't cover the liability?
Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, with regard to the issue of liability, that will be an issue as a matter of contract between the landowner, the surface owner, and who he may sell or lease the property to if he so desires. But that would be a matter of contract. You need to also remember that there's another companion bill to this, and that is House Bill 90. And House Bill 90 is the regulatory bill for this. And in that bill, although it's not before this this body at this time, we make provisions for a study for bonding and other financial assurances with regards to the liability, and that will be done by the Department of DEQ, the Oil and Gas Commission, and the State Engineer's Office, I believe, is who's in that bill. But in essence, liability for this will be ultimately a function of the instrument in which you sell, lease, or not your property. That's an issue, though, that will need to be addressed in terms of, I can assure you this, that the state of Wyoming is not and will not be in the business of assuming liability. That's been pretty clear. It's been the feeling of the committee, the governor, that we would not be the ones accepting liability for this.
Any further discussion? Senator Jennings.
Mr. Chairman, I respectfully have to disagree with the last person that you put on the list. If you go back and pick up the Wyoming Public Broadcasting one-hour interview that the chief executive did before this session started, he specifically said that in the future, the people that would have to pick up liability on this would be the state or the federal government. So if we want to go back and pull that tape out and listen to it, it might be a good thing to do.
Further discussion on Committee of the Whole. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to react to some of the things mentioned here. First of all, on the liability, I don't know that, frankly, the question of liability accrues to this particular amendment, because if it is severed, I think by that contract I have a hard time picturing somebody selling something like that and retaining the liability to it. As a matter of fact, I've heard that as one of the arguments for severability. On the other hand, if you lease out the poor space rather than sever it and sell it, well, don't walk out on me. on the other hand, if you lease it the same you do with a mineral estate, and let's say I lease out some minerals I have for CBM, and there is a blowout on, some accident on a gas well rig, and somebody gets killed, that never goes back to the owner of the minerals. I've never seen that happen. And I would love to see a case of like that in Wyoming. I would not love to see that, but I'd be interested to see a case where that came back to the mineral owner who has leased out their minerals to a company. As a matter of fact, quite often when you lease out your minerals, you suddenly find that it's gone through four or five companies before it's actually drilled. Mr. Chairman, to the question of dominance, and this may be one of the aspects of this bill that bothers me the most, it seems like we're being pretty, smug is the word that comes to me about the dominance of the minerals. Basically, as I understand what I've heard, is that that's going to be, the dominance is going to be determined by the contract between the pore space owner and the operator, whoever's going to put that in there. Now, we're talking about, let's go three generations from now, or let's say 80 years from now, because the legislature 80 years ago was in the same position with minerals in the state, and your pore space has been broken up into 25 different sections, 25 different pieces, and I've got one guy over here who's signed one contract saying one thing's dominant, another guy over here saying another thing's dominant. What we're basically saying with the bottom line on this is that the dominance is going to be determined by the courts. I think that's an abrogation of this body's responsibility. I think it should be a policy decision on the part of this legislature to decide which estate is dominant. That's what that's what they sent us down here for. I think to just sit there and say, oh, let the courts decide. I'm sorry, that just doesn't cover it for me. And the last part, Mr. Chairman, is the question about that we're somehow cutting in on people's property rights by not allowing them to sever the pore space from the surface estate. Mr. Chairman, as of now, we still don't even have, until this bill's passed, we don't have a recognition of the pore space as a separate estate at all. And when my grandfather had a ranch up in northern Wyoming, he sold a ranch. He retained the minerals. If he had known anything about pore space, I'm sure he would have retained half his pore space, as they do with minerals. So to say that we're taking something away from somebody, A, doesn't cover it. B, what if 100 years ago we had this legislature, this body, had said the same thing about adjudicated water rights? They said the adjudicated water rights on a piece of property goes with that property. And what if this legislature said, well, that is a property right, that adjudicated water right, so that could be sold. And by not allowing them to sell that adjudicated water off there, you are cutting into their property rights. Where would we be with water in this state? I was told in committee that that's not analogous. That's the only explanation I've heard that it's not analogous. I don't know why it's not analogous. It seems right on point to me. And I would love to hear an explanation to my satisfaction of why it's not analogous. Nobody seems, Mr. Chairman, when somebody buys a piece of property and if there's an adjudicated water right to it and an early one, that increases the value of that property. If that water had been removed from it 100 years ago and sold off to somebody else, what would be the value of that property? And I haven't heard anybody complain that the lack of sale, the lack of the ability to sell their adjudicated water rights somehow cuts into their property rights.
Further discussion on Committee of the Whole number ones. President Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, let's not lose sight of what we're doing here. I love talking about water rights and begatting generations after generations and always five sons coming from a Bass community. You never give it to all five sons. You only give it to one son, and that solves all those problems. But the Basque are, very intelligent group. So, let's not lose sight of what we're doing here today. And make no mistake, if this bill passes and the companion bill that goes with it, we will have set policy that is ahead of any of the other states in this union. Absolutely. We are taking on and endeavoring to figure out how do we make our energy green, if that's what the market demands. How do we ensure that for future generations, the begats on five generations down, have a mineral industry that's viable. That's what this bill does. This bill just frames it in. It's not here to solve all the problems. Nobody can foresee what all the problems are. But it provides a broad, general framework that says this is how we're going to handle what lies ahead of us looking down the road for energy. I commend the committee. They've done a good job in answering what I think are... It's hard to go out and write legislation in an area that nobody else is writing it in. We don't know all the answers. There's nobody knows all the answers when it comes to carbon sequestration or how do we reduce the carbon footprint in this state. Nobody knows how to do it. If it was easy to do, lots of other states would do it. It isn't easy. It isn't a comfortable process. And it's particularly difficult in a legislative setting. It's not what we normally do. We react to things. And now we're being asked to be proactive to what we believe the energy market will be 5 years or 10 years down the road. We can get off on tangents, talk about water rights. Water is attached to a specific square foot of land. We can get off on the begats of five generations. We can do all those things. But that's not what you're being asked to do in this legislation. You're being asked to just lay out a framework so that the people who are interested in carbon sequestration say, here's the playing field. This is what it looks like. Because no other state in the nation, and certainly not the federal government, have ever defined the playing field for carbon sequestration. Nobody does it. It's tough. It's a leap of faith. It's not, as I said, it's not what we as legislators normally do. But I think it's doable. And I think the opportunity for this state, if we can go ahead and do it, is monumental, quite frankly. So I ask you to resist this amendment. It'll lead us down tangents that we don't have to deal with yet. We will, maybe someday, maybe. But we don't have to deal with it in this piece of legislation. I ask you to defeat the amendment.
Further discussion on Committee of the Whole Amendment 1. Call for the question. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 89, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no?
No.
Boy. Committee of the Whole Amendment 1 has failed. We're on... There is another amendment, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2. Will the reading clerk please read in the amendment?
House Bill 89, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to engross copy, page 3, line 1.
Senator Bebo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 89, and I'm not sure I want to follow that resounding vote against the previous amendment. What this amendment does is if you look at the definition of pore space on page 2 of the engrossed bill and top of page 3, it eliminates three words, or other substances. And I've listened to the debate, and I really appreciate what we're doing and with this bill and where we're moving forward in unknown ground, but, you know, we're trying to codify common law. And I understand what that means, but the common law we're codifying, I worry about what it means relative to definitions we're trying to put into law now for Wyoming. And I looked at or other substances, and I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, half the time when I look at this, I like it in there, and half the time I don't like it in there. And so I'm just bringing it up as an issue for us to think about. And here's some of the things that come to my mind when I think about this and some potential problems. And we talked about liability. If you have a pore space, as I looked at it, and my good colleague from up in the northeast part of the state, if you take just a jar and fill it full of marbles, everything that's air in there is a pore space. Now, if you have a big jar and you put things into that jar, then it can move to a pore space. So you could technically have a pore space in the middle of a reservoir. I don't know that you can or can't, but you could have. So what happens in that pore space if for some reason part of the hydrocarbon should move into that pore space or other things move into that pore space. So does that mean it belongs to the surface owner? Does that mean it belongs to the mineral estate? Don't know the answer. And if it does belong to the mineral owner, does the surface owner have any liability? Or if it's his, does he have any liability? Don't know the answer. I looked at uranium. When you look at the way uranium is deposited in the roll fronts, which you use for in situ mining, and it's really not in a pore space, it's in the rock. So there's pore space next to it, and when you put in the solution to remove it from the rock, you move it into the pore space. I don't know what that does. The storage issue of natural gas, I think, has been resolved because it says nothing shall change in prior common law, so I think that issue has been resolved. But these are just some questions I had, and the thing I know, Mr. Chairman, is that this is a work in progress. I think a lot of effort's gone into it. I don't know that we know the answers today, and because I'm not sure whether my amendment's a good amendment or not, because I don't understand it, really, what we're doing here, I'd like to have some answers, and I'm going to probably withdraw my amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2, Senator Nicholas.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I mean, the first and obvious response to this is that you got to remember you're looking at stack gases that have been somewhat purified. You're not going to have pure CO2. And the notion that you're going to have to pump in only carbon dioxide as an element is pretty impractical. So what you've said then by taking other substances is that you have to take your stack gases and you have to purify them down to pure CO2. That's simply not going to happen. There are going to be other elements that are going to be injected in with these stack gases. So for that reason alone, you should defeat the amendment. With respect to the liability issue, by allowing the severances, we have, and I'm not sure if this bill or the next bill we're talking about, but the liability resides with the entity that is putting the stack gases into the ground. With respect to this, the liability stands there. With respect to the long-term liability, we're going to do some pilot projects to see what it is. But it looks like, by all the evidence that we've been provided, is that these saline domes are stable enough that over time they just become more and more stable and that there will be no escape and no long-term impact. And we'll be doing studies to make sure. Right now, to adopt your amendment would, in essence, require 100% science, just extract the CO2, and only CO2 would render the whole project or concept uneconomical.
Further discussion? Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I once again would rise in opposition to an amendment. There's been some... In the national presidential election, there has been some question about stealing other people's words or using them or paraphrasing them, and I'm going to do that today, but I'm going to give credit to whom it's due, and that's to the good legislator from representative from Gillette. Basically, what he says and the words that he has used is that, first of all, you got to remember what we're doing here, that the surface owner owns the strata and the pore spaces below the ground. Below the surface. What he would say is that is like, if you adopt this amendment, it's like owning a parking lot and telling the owner of the parking lot that he only can park red cars there. Fact of the matter is that it confuses the common law. It will confuse what does he only own a part of the pore spaces or not? That's what this amendment would ultimately do, I believe. Would only own the pore spaces for just CO2 and nothing else? As the good senator said from Albany County, there are other substances, other gases, whatever it might be, that might be injected with the CO2, and there may be other substances in the ground already. But given that, I would think that this... should be defeated
just as it was in the House.
Further discussion. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, slightly different question, and I too think I'm probably against this amendment because it seems to me that it's inconsistent with the effort to codify the common law. My question is why it was not written storage space for substances, leaving out the carbon dioxide. Why the specificity in the carbon dioxide? Wouldn't the common law just allow you to use it for any substances? And if the amendment were to pass, then you would have really changed things fairly drastically by just restricting it to the CO2.
Further discussion, Committee of the Whole? Seeing none. Ready for the question?
Oh,
Senator DeBevoe.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to withdraw that amendment.
Seeing no other objection, the amendment is withdrawn. We have another amendment on here, the Bebout Amendment. Would the clerk please read it in?
House Bill 89, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 3 to engrossed copy, page 1, line 11.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move third reading, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 3 to House Bill 89. And this one, I think, and the reason I withdrew the other amendment is because I, as I stated earlier, I had some conflict both ways of whether it was a good amendment or not. And my colleague from Albany County brought something forward I hadn't thought about, and that's the different kinds of gases you'd have, stack gases with CO2. But what this amendment does is very clearly states, and all that we have talked about the mineral estate being the dominant estate, it very clearly says that nothing in this section shall be construed to change or alter the ownership of oil, gas, or other minerals that may be located in or migrate to. And the concern I have, again, is what I mentioned earlier, and you talk about the parking lot. And I understand we don't want to, I shouldn't be able to control a red car, and I agree with that. That's part of why I withdrew my amendment. But what about a car that I don't want in my parking lot? And how do you deal with that? And that's where I think the mineral estate comes in, and I think that, and I'm trying to think of, if I'm a landowner, a surface, and I own the pore space, and something could happen that something could come into that pore space that I have the liability for dealing with minerals, and I'm thinking of uranium possibly a tertiary flood, something like that. Do I want to have that responsibility? And I think it should be with the mineral estate, which is the dominant estate, and I think this language does that.
Further discussion on Committee of the Whole number 3. Senator Scott.
Chairman, a question on this amendment. If in the process of extracting a mineral, say you're using an in situ process or something like that, you move things into the pore space, like the acid or whatever is used for the extraction, and move some of the mineral in there as part of the process of removing it, and I imagine you'll probably leave some behind. I can't imagine the process being perfect about getting it out of the rock and moving it all out. Does this amendment protect you under those circumstances? I would think we would want to pretend. Maybe there's something else in the bill that does. I would think that would be a protection we would want. And I'm wondering if this amendment does that, or is that a separate issue?
Further discussion, Senator Perkins.
On and against the amendment, Mr. Chairman, with respect to this, if you want to turn to page 3 and look at the lines we're talking about, 4 through 11, let's go back and just for a moment look at what the bill as proposed does, and let's go ahead and let's for a moment just for hypothetical reasons take the good senator from Cheyenne's suggestion that we eliminate all of the trailing examples that are in there, so that it would read, nothing in this section shall be construed to change, alter the common laws of July 1st, 2008 as it relates to the rights belonging to the dominance of the mineral estate, period. And then if that was language to come out, because the rest of that is just a list that has to do along with the mineral estate, then this would read, then we'd start again, and nothing in this section shall be construed to change, alter the ownership of oil, gas, or other minerals that may be located in or migrate to the spore space. I would suggest to you that those are saying essentially the same thing. And why I say that is that the mineral estate, it includes all of those things necessary to develop or produce and realize the benefit of your mineral estate. And it's obvious from the development of mineral estate that you have to push at times minerals through pore spaces to get what it needs to be. You have to do that in obviously an enhanced oil recovery. You've got to do it in uranium. You've got to do it in all kinds of those things. Those are things that are integral to and a part of your right to develop their minerals. And there, I would suggest to you that there's nothing in this bill. In fact, this bill makes it clear, even without this language, that that is a dominant right, and those rights are unaffected by this bill. And I would liken this amendment to simply say, is very close to saying that the common law gives you all the rights to have in your mineral estate, and then the amendment would say, and we really mean it. I don't know how else to put that. It's basically saying it again, and I would suggest to you that it's frivolous language, and you get into the issue when you write it then. All of a sudden, that means that we've changed the meaning. That means that the meaning we have that's already in the bill has somehow changed because we're insisting on modifying that language again. And so once again, we open up the door to, okay, well, if this means what this means, then how is that different? And obviously, the line before it means something else. And so when you get into the statutory construction, when we re-say that again, we're opening the door for further interpretation, and I think, which actually harms the rights of the mineral owner as opposed to keeping them intact, which we're trying to do.
Further discussion, committee to hold three. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against amendment, and let me give the body a little history here. When the bill came out of the Joint Judiciary Committee in the interim, paragraph E on page 3 ended with a period after the dominance of the mineral estate, period. That was it. When the bill was amended in the other body, it was at the request of one particular mineral energy company, and the thought has been, and we have now since during the break met with members of the House, met with industry, that probably the good senator from Laramie County made a very valid point. And that is when you start building these lists and you start putting in certain things, and then if there's some litigation later on down the road, Supreme Court or the court that's looking that says, well, they included all these things but didn't include this, they must have intended not to do that. And ultimately, you may end up infecting some rights that we're better off with language that just basically stops at the and leaves it at the mineral estate period. And I think that's pretty clear. I have consent from the prime authors of this legislation and so forth to that does make more sense. I've had comments from industry that does make sense. So in second reading, I intend to bring amendment with other sponsors to take this back and take out that long list. I think that makes it clear and it protects everybody's rights in that regard. But on and against this amendment, I would also say that this perhaps is a little, I'm not clear on this. We recognize the dominance of the mineral estate, but you don't own the mineral. You own the mineral estate, but you don't really have real vested ownership until you sever it. That's when it takes place. And I'm not sure about this when we start talking about migration and so forth. So I don't know that I can fully answer that, but I would speak against this amendment at this point in time.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you. This amendment addresses an area that we didn't really dive into. It doesn't belong in this section. It may be appropriate to take another look at it overnight, but you're talking about an entirely different issue here. And the issue here now is that the mineral estate owner owns, really generally speaking, the natural or the natural, let's call it for a moment, oil and gas minerals that lie below their property. When you begin the issue of talking about migrating oil and gas, the rules change. And it real also has a large impact whether or not that oil and gas has ever been captured. And let's take gas for an example. If you capture the gas, that is, you bring it to the surface and you take it and put it in a pipeline and re-inject it into a storage facility, into a salt dome. Captured gas, well, who owns that, generally speaking? And it happens quite frequently because you have, we use domes to store natural gas. And there's reams and reams of articles, and different states have adopted different laws. But generally, the owner of captured gas is probably going to be the owner who captured the gas and then reinjected into the formation. Now, there are some states that have not accepted that, and they said you put it down in the ground, you run the risk that your neighbor can pump out your captured gas, them's the breaks. But most states have now gone to the notion that if you're going to store captured gas into an underground storage facility, that the whoever purchased the staff gas and reinjected it. Then the question, what happens if it combines with other gas molecules, difficult issue. So now I think what the gist of the motion is, says that we're just not going to get into that battle. We're not going to resolve through this legislation who owns the oil and gas. And if you begin CO2 injection, all of a sudden it frees up or, let's say, concentrates natural gas in some part, then whoever owned that still owns it. And if the CO2 project disperses gas, and so, for example, I'm a landowner, and I agree to the CO2 project, and there was natural gas that was previously not commercially extractable, all of a sudden anything that was residual in there begins to migrate outwards into somebody else's property. Who then owns it? And probably in that case, until it's captured, it's on whose ever land or mineral rights it gets there, and them's the breaks. You push your gas to somebody else's property, you probably lose that right. I'm not sure that it's, I think this is one that I'd urge you to reject for now. If we're going to put it in, we put it in as a separate section. It does not belong in the same category as the right of the mineral estate being dominated. That's an entirely different. You can have a dominant mineral estate own the rights to the minerals and may not own the right to captured gas underneath that estate. Lots of litigation out there on that topic. And so we could put another section and then address that issue, say this bill just does not address the issue of gas that's either migrated off because of the CO2 project or that has been, for example, what there could be hydrocarbons that are being reinjected. There might be there are all kinds of issues there. I'm not sure how to deal with it, but I do know it doesn't belong in this section. And then maybe we come back, we discuss a little bit more, but requires some thought.
Further discussion? Seeing none, ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion to adopt a standing the Committee of the Whole, number 3 amendment to House Bill 89, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no?
No.
Another tight one. Committee of the Whole, number 3 amendment has failed. We're back on the bill. No further discussion. All those in favor of Senator Ross's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 89, please say aye. Opposed, no. House Bill 89 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Our next bill for consideration is House Bill 38. Would the Chief Clerk or the reading clerk please read in the bill?
House Bill 38, Medicaid Provider Reimbursements, an act relating to Medicaid, sponsored by the Labor Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services. The report's back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye. Senators Ullman, Feck, Hastert, Landon, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move from the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 38 do pass. Mr. Chairman, I believe there are no standing committee amendments, and I will briefly seek to explain the bill, and I will represent to the Senate that this is a lot easier bill to understand than the previous one. Mr. President, we've been developing a problem in the health and social services area, and it has to do with how you deal with the effects of inflation. In our budgeting process, and this is, I would call the attention of the Appropriations Committee, this is a bill about budgeting process. The state government and the bureaucracy is pretty well taken care of in the standard budget process. You get an escalation as inflation sets in. We, in the rest of the state government, we do use private contractors to quite an extent, but it tends to be on a job-by-job basis, like a highway project. They get a bid on that particular project. You don't have to, that takes care of the problems of inflation. We have to deal with the consequences, but the private contractors don't get deprived. In the Medicaid area, you have a series of private providers who continue from one year to the next. They don't come in and bid separately every year. They just continue from one year to the next. And there isn't a good mechanism for increasing the reimbursements as you get inflation. And what's happened is we've seen it over time that particular groups of providers will get the feeling that they've been left out. They go hire a lobbyist, and they make a big political effort, and we do an ad hoc increase in their particular reimbursements. And that is not really a very satisfactory system. And we've seen quite a few problems because of it, and have had some problems with obtaining services in certain areas because of the nature of that process. What this bill seeks to do is say that consideration ought to be part of the biennial budget process. So it tells the health department to every 2 years, in conjunction with the budget process, propose a reimbursement schedule for the providers and give some factors to be used, and has an exception for those that we've already got on a different system. And there are a couple of those, Mr. Chairman. It will not affect anything that happens in the current biennium, but what it will mean, and I particularly call the Appropriations Committee attention to this, is that in the next biennium, you'll see from the Health Department a proposal to deal with provider reimbursement in all these other areas. And you'll have to either agree with it or say no and bring us the results. But it'll be a much more regular process, and I think will lead to a much fairer and more rational system of dealing with this particular problem. Mr. Chairman, with that, I would urge the Senate to pass the bill and stand ready to answer any questions.
Any further discussion on House Bill 38? Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm against this bill and we'll listen to more discussion, but what I see here is, and we have seen it out of the groups that depend on Department of Health for revenues, the notion that they ought to have embedded in their process a cost of living increase procedure. Some groups want specific COLAs. It's a great way to be, and to say that before you go fixing your budget, we want to make sure that our cost of living increases are calculated in, and so they're not up for debate for all other state requirements. This stops short of that. What this says is that before the budgeting process, that the Department of Health will bring directly to the Appropriations Committee a reimbursement schedule where they define, they go out and make their assessments and they determine whether or not you're meeting, just jump to the usual and customary charges, and proposing to the JAC a chart upon which we're to act. I don't know that we would be capable of doing it, but it also, to begin with, it circumvents the budget process insofar as the way the system presently works is the Department of Health is an executive branch entity. The Department of Health from time to time wants increases at any given time. It meets with the chief executive, the governor. It sits down with the governor and goes over all of its needs. The governor then determines and gives direction. The Department of Health determines what to put in its budget. The governor has issues before the process even begins. The governor puts out instructions to his agencies and says, when you bring budgets to us, this is what we want to have in the budgets. What we're doing in this case with this bill is saying we're going to disregard anything that the governor's instructions. Now the legislature is going to give instructions to the agency, tell them how to prepare their budget and what we expect to see, and essentially we don't care what your instructions are from your chief executive office, sir. We don't care what those issues are. You bring this forward to the budget process. And as I began to explain this, it occurs to me that there is, in this sense, a separation of powers issues, because while it's fair enough for us to require things to be put in the standard budget, it's fair enough for us to have a report made to committees. I do have a problem with now injecting ourselves into the budget process and requiring that agencies provide a specific schedule to the chief executive, the governor, and directing, in essence, if the governor doesn't like that, it still comes on to appropriations. So I'd urge caution on this, and I think on and against the bill.
Further discussion, Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this in no way seeks to circumvent the budget process. And notice we did not say that this goes automatically into the standard budget. What we want is to have these come forward, and frankly, I think it's a matter of negotiation between the Appropriations Committee and the Budget Office as to whether these increases should be shown in an exception budget or not. I'm presuming they are increases, and I think we can pretty well count that they will be. What we're saying is let's take a systematic look at this issue in the budgeting process every 2 years, because the way it's working right now is simply not fair, not reasonable, and is calling on us, all of us here, to judge in the merits of specific increases for specific groups of providers. And I don't think that's really a particularly good way to do things. The ones that are the best organized, and it goes on the principle the squeaking wheel gets the grease, as opposed to a regular systematic look, which is, I think, really what the budget process ought to do, is give us a systematic look at this kind of issue. I don't see any separation of powers issues any more than a request for doing things in some particular format would be. I think it's just trying to get a regular way of dealing with this issue, which is not being satisfactorily dealt with at the current time.
Further discussion, Senator Nicholas.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would disagree that on the statement that says this is not being adequately addressed at the current time. This has been, it may be, that if you're a particular advocate for a particular group of people, or for more reimbursement for physicians, or more reimbursements in certain areas, then, of course, you would might conclude that it's not a particularly good way to do it. But it's the way we treat everybody else in the budget process. What this does is inject a bias in the entire budget process to say this group is different than everybody else. With respect to this group, we want you to prepare the information because we think that they're entitled to different special treatment. If it's the Department of Corrections, if you take a look at the, for example, the what we call the Section 900 series throughout the budget, the contract systems, in many instances, whether it be the Department of Corrections, Family Services, or a number of other entities, the Section 900s address services that we expect to continue from year to year. And those service providers, in each and every case, would like to have a built-in cost of living adjustment or a statute just like this that says every 2 years you will consider whether or not we're entitled as a contracted provider more money or a cost of living index. It would be a very, the suggestion is that there can be no stationary budgets, that all budgets should grow from year to year because our costs are going up. And I submit to you that's not good budgeting. It's not what our constituents expect us to do. Our constituents expect us to look at budgets from year to year, determine where we can save money, how can we can save money. It's not how can we spend more money. It's not who should get more money. It's every year scrutinizing every item. And these folks are, in the present budget process, treated like each and every other group that exists. If you think you're underfunded, you make an exception request. The exception request goes to the governor as considered. He considers all of them, and then it comes to the budget. But to say, look, everybody, in fact, the governor often gives instructions that I don't want to see any exceptions this year unless they're absolutely necessary, unless the state will come crashing down. And that's an instruction he expects to be adhered to. And if he doesn't, you don't adhere to him, he fires people, and he can fire people for doing it because that's the budget process. And now we're saying, notwithstanding that, here's a special group. You don't have to go through that process. You don't have to listen to it. We're going to treat you differently. We want to take a look at what you think are the appropriate increases without having to go through the instructions that are delivered to you. You're a special group. And, folks, they're not a special group. When you look at our approximately, just in our general fund, $3.4 billion worth of appropriations going out, there are many, many groups out there that would like to have this type of treatment, and all of them are equal. And now to segregate out one group and say, you're special, that's not an appropriate budgetary process.
Further discussion. Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there is a special group, and that's the state agencies. And the state bureaucracy, they get automatically escalated in the standard budget. Now, that's not what we're asking here. We're asking that there be a systematic look at the reimbursements for the providers in this area. And we've had, in recent years, quite a number of problems in this area. For example, increases in the obstetric area were not keeping pace with the costs, and the result is that there's no longer obstetric services available in Weston County. We passed a special provision after that, but it was I think it's been effective in keeping the problem from spreading. But we got in trouble first. We had any number of special increases in the legislation that we passed last year because the Health Care Commission found that providers in this area were not getting sufficient reimbursement. We've made a special process for nursing homes because we found that they weren't able to compete in the job market, and there were deficiencies showing up because they couldn't hire enough staff. And that's a special process that's in the statute and does come, I think, through in the standard budget. We've had just one problem after another in this area because our process does not deal adequately with the ongoing providers. It deals just fine with the one-time, you know, you bid a separate contract every time sort of circumstance. But with these ongoing providers, our budget process is not dealing with the problem, and we need to look at it. It doesn't put it in the standard budget, doesn't call for any particular result, but it does require us to look at it, and I think it's just good budgeting. I would urge the Senate to adopt it.
Further discussion? Question having been called, all those... Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I want to address a couple of things. First of all, if you think that the standard budget grows on its own, that's a myth. It does not. There is something that's called a base budget, which is the base budget that goes from year to year. It's a base budget based upon prior appropriations that we build in. The standard budget is the base budget adjusted by appropriations that we, the legislature, make. Nothing goes into the to a standard budget except that we appropriate it. If the base budget for an agency right today or yesterday was 100 positions, if this legislature authorizes four more positions in this budget bill, then the base budget will come in next year at the old base budget, plus the standard budget will then be standardized for the four positions that were appropriated and authorized by the legislature. Nothing goes into the standard budget except that it's based upon an appropriation. Now, we do on occasion provide, and we did in this case, the governor recommended a cost of living adjustment for state employees of 4%. If we approve it, that will be the next time get standardized because we approve it. That's an overall cost. But nothing inflates without a legislative appropriation. I want you, that's a myth, the notion that it grows on its own or grows automatically. It doesn't. It can only grow by appropriations that we've authorized. With respect to obstetrics, that's a perfect example of what we do do. That's what the legislature addresses. A peculiar problem was brought to the attention of the legislature. It was undertaken an examination by our standing committee. A recommendation was made to take them to 100% reimbursement, and that was done. But part of the budget process is also to constrain growth. And when you constrain growth, we simply don't invite everybody to come in and said, whatever you think you need, you get in the budget process. The constraining system is that you have to think that it's, we call it an exception process. It's an exception process because it's exceptional, not just because it'd be nice to have. And when it reaches the level of an exceptional quest, you make an exception quest to the governor and it comes through the process. And this says, is in essence saying, here is an exceptional thing year in and year out, and it's not. And we've been going, and regardless of what people think, these programs are adequately funded at the time. I'd urge that we vote this bill down now.
Further discussion on House Bill 38. Seeing none, question being called. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 38, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
House Bill 38 has failed, and according to having failed the standard division vote, a roll call vote is required. Chief Clerk will take the roll.
Division, excuse me.
All those in favor of House Bill 38, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. Having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. Chief Clerk will take the roll.
Anderson?
No.
Allman?
Aye.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Coe?
No.
Cooper?
Aye.
Dicaria?
Aye.
Vecht?
Aye.
Geis?
No.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hines?
No.
Jennings?
Aye.
Job?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Landon?
Aye.
Larson?
No.
Massey?
Aye.
Meyer?
No.
Mockler?
No.
Nicholas?
No.
Perkins?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Ross?
No.
Scott?
Aye.
Sessions?
Aye.
Townsend?
No.
Basie?
Aye.
Von Flatern?
Aye.
President Schiffer?
No.
Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 13 ayes, 17 noes.
House Bill 38, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. Next bill for our consideration. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate be in recess for 10 minutes.
Oh, you've heard the motion. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
So what did Patty decide?
Yeah. Thank you.
Senate come back to order, please?
Senate's back in session. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 30. Would the reading clerk please read it in?
House Bill 30, Modernization of Court Procedure, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to courts. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, DeCaria, Perkins, Ross, and Sessions. Senator Ross, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Ross?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee hold rise and report it do so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 30. There is a standing committee amendment, and I'd ask that it be read in at this time.
Would the clerk please read it in?
House Bill 30, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 3, line 18.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 30 and yield to the floor to the good senator from Uinta County to talk about the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment.
Senator DeCaria.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this bill was brought forward by the Board of Judicial Policy and Administration. For those of you that may be not familiar with that, that is a Supreme Court kind of organization as far as looking at policies and laws that affect the judiciary. Mr. Chairman, this legislation eliminates archaic language that is still in statute. Mr. Chairman, I'll go through those sections just so that we're clear on what each one of these does. On page 1, 121-203, this is in the small claims statute, and they're taking out the provision that says that the request of the circuit court judge shall draft the affidavit for the claimant. As it works now in small claims court, the claimant can come into court in small claims court. This is small claims court. If they are interested in that, the claimant, the person who is bringing the action, they get a form. They just need to fill out the form and submit it. So there is no need for a circuit court or any other judge to fill out an affidavit in that. It's not done currently. It hasn't been done for years. And so it's just pulling that out. Mr. Chairman, on page 256-106, it just is removing the word justice of the peace. If you remember, those of you who've been around a while, and if not, justice of the peace don't exist in the state of Wyoming anymore. All that duty is now taken up with the circuit courts. Mr. Chairman, on the next page, which would be 59119, it's again just taking out justice of the peace. They don't exist, and removing that provision. Mr. Chairman, on page 3, section 2, which is a repealer, this is just taking out the requirements for court recorders. It's not that they won't have requirements. It's just that they're in the court rules, and they're much easier to leave in the court rules because as they need to change with the court recorders, they can adjust for the needs of those. It's not something that every time that, you know, we have to come back every time that there's a change and change the statute. This is just allows it to be done in court rules. And Section 3, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to talk about because this is where the Standing Committee Amendment goes to. It was just the thought of the committee that since what we're doing here is pretty straightforward, instead of waiting for the normal enactment date of July 1, 2008, that we should just enact it immediately as the amendment reads, the standard language, completion of all acts necessary for a bill to become law. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions on the Standing Committee Amendment, and I would call for the question.
Further discussion on Standing Committee Number 1, House Bill 30. Seeing none.
All those in favor of Senator Ross's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 30, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Standing Committee 1 has passed the Committee of the Whole. We're up back on the bill. Question having been called on the bill, all those in favor of Senator Ross's motion when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 30, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 30 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 36. Will the reading clerk please read it in?
House Bill 36, Uniform Law on Notarial Acts, an act relating to notaries and notarial acts, sponsored by Representative Gingrich. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, Coe, Jennings, Massey, Von Flatern, Senator Coe, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee the whole rise and report it. Do so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 36 and defer to Senator Massey for an explanation of the standing committee amendment and the bill.
Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll briefly explain the bill as well as the amendment going through, and at the end of the explanation, I'll move the amendment for consideration.
Read it. You want to read in?
At that particular point, I will. Mr. Chairman, this bill seeks to revise a 1939 provision in our laws with regard to the work of notaries. It's outdated, and it's really out of sync with an awful lot of the notary laws that are in operation elsewhere in the United States as well as the world. This bill reflects the 1982 Uniform Law on Notarial Acts that was created by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, which Wyoming is a member. Essentially what this bill does is replace the 1939 Act with this 1982 Uniform Law. It helps to simplify and standardize the practice of notaries in the state of Wyoming, as well as the forms that they use. It also makes it easier for the work of the notary publics in Wyoming to be recognized elsewhere in the country and for the work elsewhere in the country to be recognized here in Wyoming. The 1938 law is repealed in this bill, Mr. Chairman, and folks can see that at the bottom of page 32 in the repealer section. All but one of those repealers pertain to the provisions of the 1939 Act. The first section of the bill is new language, Mr. Chairman, and replaces those repealed acts with this 1982 Uniform Law. And on page 2 of the bill are the definitions for the notarial acts in the state of Wyoming in this new Uniform Law. Over on page 4, under 34-26-102, is the discussion of the definition of taking an acknowledgement as well as taking a verification. 103 of the bill, which starts over on page 7, discusses who could perform these notarial acts in the state of Wyoming. In addition to the notary public on page 7, it notes the other folks who can perform these acts. Section 104, starting on page 8, discusses who can perform these acts in other states and how that's recognized in Wyoming and how our work in Wyoming is recognized elsewhere. The federal authority is over in Section 105, and it primarily deals with military bases and how the work of notary publics can be recognized in military bases elsewhere in the country and vice versa. The foreign notarial acts are noted in Section 106 on page 11, and that new language there discusses the process for recognizing the notary work elsewhere in the world and, again, vice versa, and that's the primary reason for this bill. Section 107, starting on page 13, a description of what an acknowledgement should look like, a notarial acknowledgement. Subsection A discusses the content or the specifics of that. Subsection B discusses other things that are included in those acknowledgements, including a short form. And Section 108 does contain that short form, which is being placed in statute through this bill. Over on Section 109 is a grandfather clause, Mr. Chairman, and that is it recognizes any notary work or any notarial acts that were performed before the effective date of this law and gives them full credence and therefore recognition. And so we're not repealing something after the fact. And so that's the grandfather clause. Down on page 19, Mr. Chairman, as you know, we found a word missing in line 20.
The word be was accidentally left out of the transcript, and the amendment seeks to put the word be back in on line 20 after the first word to. Over on page 20, Mr. Chairman, 3426110 is essentially an intent clause, and the committee, through its standing committee amendment, is recommending deleting that intent clause from the bill. Both of these proposed changes were fine with the primary sponsor of the bill. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, Section 2, which is about a third of the bill, is just simply changing notary public to notarial officer. Once again, that's part of the 1982 Uniform Law on Notarial Acts, and the definition for those officers is over on page 22, I believe. Yes, it is. And, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill. I would ask for the Standing Committee amendment to be read in.
Reading clerk, please.
House Bill 36, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engrossed copy, page 1, line 9.
Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 36, and it's been explained and asked for favorable consideration.
Further discussion on the we're on the Standing Committee Amendment? Having seen none, all those in favor of Senator Massey's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has passed. Back on the bill, Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be glad to answer any questions about the bill and ask for the positive consideration of the floor.
Further discussion, Senator Bebo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One quick question. Will the existing notaries have to refile with the state, pay any other additional fees, get new stamps or anything if this becomes law?
Senator Massey, sorry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good question. I don't think so, because that never came up in a committee with anyone who testified. It was nothing that the sponsor said, but I will find that out for certain and let the requester know for second reading.
Further discussion on the bill. Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I really wonder why we're not putting this bill through the process of an interim study to a committee to look at it. For example, right now, if you look at, just open up your statutes to the, in Wyoming, which would be called the Acknowledgement Act form of acknowledgement, which is at 34-2-115. In our statutes, we have identified, and if you're a notary, you have to not only look at your notary statutes, but you have to go to the Acknowledgement Act for, and under the Acknowledgement Act for real estate, you have separate requirements. And in fact, right now, you with this statute, you will have a conflict. Because if you look at our statutory requirement for a statutory acknowledgement, it is different than the form that is being proposed in this new act. In fact, if you look at page 16, lines 16 through 19, that is inconsistent with and different from the Acknowledgement Act form in the uniform, what we call the Wyoming Acknowledgement Act. And this is the kind of thing that we need to make sure that we avoid, and it's the kind of thing that interim committees look at and they study so you don't come up with conflicts. Wyoming, in fact, there is a statutory form of acknowledgement, and there's a long debate of whether or not you need to adhere expressly to the provision on there, and maybe the act was repealed, the entire act, but I don't. Maybe I'll learn more as we go there. But I guess, why aren't we going through it? And I do see now that 34.2.114 through 120 is repealed, so that you begin a process now of an entire education. I guess we'll all get educated as we go through. But as we begin to make these gross changes, you know, I just wonder why don't we go through the interim process. And not everything that Nick Huzel does is the best thing since sliced bread.
Further discussion on the bill. Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think if I was listening carefully there, I think that the person, my colleague from Laramie, answered most of his questions as he went along there. I think the remaining question was why we didn't go through an interim study, and I guess it's because not everything that we do here that's worthwhile goes through an interim study. This seems to have had the support of everybody as it has gone along. Nobody showed up for the committee meeting, and the Education Committee has complained about this. I haven't received any complaints or emails, expressed any kind of concerns. So I'm not really quite sure why this would require an interim study of a committee. We have a pretty big workload as it is. And again, the concern about conflicting forms and conflicting language was taken care of because that particular section of the law, which was outdated, 1939, and there's only two other states in the country that have that language left in their statutes anymore, is being repealed and taken out simply because we can update our practice and be able to work much better with the other states that are doing these very types of things.
Further discussion on the bill.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 36, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 36 is passed the Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our...
consideration is House Bill 22. Would the clerk please read the bill?
House Bill 22, Failure to Observe Road Closure, sponsored by Representative Madden, an act relating to highways. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, Military Affairs. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Geis, Hastert, Johnson, Landon, Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Von Flatern?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill 22. And, fellow senators, is this a failure to observe road closures? This bill is very simple. You go to top of the page 2 on there, and that's the whole change to the bill. Since 1954, it's been $100 to pass a barrier, to cross a barrier put up by the Highway Patrol or the Department of Transportation and continue down a road that they designated as closed. So $100 doesn't seem like a lot. Back then, it was probably a couple weeks' worth of pay. To go to $750 is about what the max is for littering. It's the max for passing a school bus. And when you've seen the pictures they gave us in the committee that detailed the mess on the road after a blizzard, after people, some who had been caught on the road in between barriers, that they pointed out. But a lot of the people had run the barrier, gone around it, been caught out there, had to be hauled in. Emergency services, Department of Transportation plow operators are all out there picking these people up. They do get fined, $100. Not that big a deal for all the expense the state goes through. There was one story last spring, last April. We had quite a snowstorm up on I-90, shut I-90 down from Montana to South Dakota line. Some snowmobilers coming from out of state were headed up to the Bighorns, came against the barrier at Gillette, and looked at the sign. If you notice, they're all posted. It says up to a maximum $100 fine. Looked at the sign, looked at the DOT official that was there, which I believe was one of the snowplow crews, looked at each other and said, "Look, we can afford $25 each. We've got reservations," and off they went. Well, they were cited before they got to Buffalo, or by the time they got to Buffalo, coughed up $25 each and called it good. In that meantime, if they had gotten stuck, you'd have had a rescue crew or a snowplow crew or somebody picking them up. You would have had the danger we're putting our own DOT people into. And then the other thing is they showed us pictures that next day where the snowplow is now trying to work its way around these vehicles that are all stuck, several of who had ran the barriers. And the time it took, they said the one opening between Sheridan and Buffalo was delayed 9 hours, trying to move enough vehicles out of the way and get one path cut through it that they could have opened it up 9 hours earlier. So it's a very simple bill, $750. If you want to compare it to 1950 money, we should have probably gone a lot higher, but this is at least matching what our littering standards are, maximum 750, passing a school bus. They're all within sync with each other. I ask for your favorable vote on House Bill 22.
Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. Chairman, when you propose this kind of an increase in a fine for violating a law that I routinely violate, it gets my attention. Mr. Chairman, I don't think this bill is quite ready for prime time. And let me explain the problem we've got in my district, my area, and I suspect a number of the other rural areas. Mr. Chairman, I and a number of my neighbors live on State Highway 487. It runs from Clark's Corner up on Highway 220 down to Medicine Bow. That road is frequently closed, has been frequently closed this winter because of problems with snow in Shirley Basin. And let me tell you, closed or open, you don't want to go anywhere near Shirley Basin when there's blowing snow. That road is truly awful. I got caught there once. It didn't go around the gate. They closed it after I'd gone through it. And it really is awful. You don't want any part of it. The trouble is that they closed the road on the northern end at 220. There are a number of ranches and a schoolhouse and a small business that are in the first 20 miles of that road. They are not affected by the stretch that causes the closure. It's perfectly safe to go to those places, and everybody that lives there knows it. And we've talked to the highway department about moving the road closed sign, but it makes a fair amount of sense to have it where they have it, because for the people that want to go to Medicine Bow, the quicker they know the road's closed and they shouldn't ought to go there, the better. So you put it clear at the northern end. And what happens is those of us who live on that northern end that are not affected just go around the barrier. And frequently, this winter, I come out to go to some appointment in town, and the first I know the barrier is closed is when I come off the road and go past it on the way in, and I got to pass the closed barrier on the way home if I want to get home. I think this circumstance is not all that unusual in the rural area. I can remember Senator Barton bringing legislation to try to deal with that problem. It had some problems and didn't get through for one reason or another, but it was a problem up in that corner of the state. And I think until we get some of these problems straightened out, it would be best to think twice about increasing this fine. I suppose maybe we could come back in second reading and if it gets to second reading and put in some exceptions or something like that. But the road closed system has got some real difficulties with it. Some places where it closes perfectly safe roads, and if enforced, would cause considerable hardship. And I'm not too worried about my own case. I can drive through my pasture and get around the sign if I have to. But it would be a real inconvenience for quite a number of my constituents, and I suspect we're not the only circumstance. I think the highway department has to have a better system on this sort of thing before we go increasing the penalties in this particular area. And there is a real problem, because when you get into the stretch of road, whether it's the road I'm talking about or any of the others in the state that's caused them to close it, you don't want to be there when it's closed. And you shouldn't be there because it's not safe. But the trouble is that they close great sections of the road and are a real problem for the rural folks when there's no justification for that part of the road being closed.
Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I can fully appreciate all that's been said by the good senator from Casper, and I, too, live in a rural area and have had some of the same experiences. I do, however, want to remind you, and I can't give you all the detail because my recall in the whole incident is not perfect, but in my district there was a death of a snowplow driver that was as a result of someone who had run the barricade. And I just would hope at this point that we can move this bill forward past first reading and we can explore perhaps some ways to make some necessary adjustments to, in fact, recognize that there are some serious consequences if we fail to observe this, and would urge your passage on first reading.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Geis.
In the committee hearing, DOT will issue you a card if you go to the headquarters there and allow you to go up through there. And they also are considering moving that barrier up to the maintenance shop right at the foot of Shirley Basin. So I think we can go ahead and pass this bill, and you can tell your neighbors to get a hold of the superintendent, and I think they'll give you a card to say it's okay for Charlie Scott to go up to his ranch.
Senator Nicholas.
Well, you know, I have great empathy for the senator from Casper. I encountered the same problem issue this Monday. I get off, started heading over here. Now, if you go up I-80, you have a choice to go I-80 or you can go through the Snowy Range Road. And when you hit the barricade at I-80 on this particular Monday morning, I needed to get back here for a committee meeting, although maybe somebody didn't want me to be here, but I needed to get back. As I hit the barricade, I see there's tracks going through the barricade. And so in that case, I called the dispatch. They referred me to the port of entry. They referred me to the dispatch. And now recognize that if you live on the top of the summit up in the areas that on the Happy Jack Road, oftentimes you get regularly, routinely go through the barricades to go home, but you have to know when and, I suppose, how to do it. So I called, and here's the message I generally got. I asked if I could go through the barricade to come to and go on the Happy Jack Road or come straight through. And the instruction I have is, well, we're allowing necessary mobile traffic. Well, I kind of felt I was necessary, and I know that the senator from Teton County may not think I was necessary that day if I was defeated. And I was mobile. I was in a car. So, and I suppose if you know the jargon, at some point you go through it, you head through. But I violated this because I did willfully fail to observe that sign, marker, warning, notice, and headed through there. And I know that there are three tracks in front of me. It's fairly routine. And while you may think there's a good system to deal with it and that it's easy to get a card, anybody that finds himself some urgency calling and getting a message that says, well, we're not restricting, and sometimes I think I've actually, local traffic's okay. You can get a variety of instructions. And, folks, it is. I don't care. You're violating the statute. There's no provision in this to say you can call and get a special instruction to, and you won't be picked up. And I know that every time you do it, you go up there and you're clamped up because you're not quite sure what that instruction was. You kind of think it was okay, and you hope like heck you don't get stopped. And ordinarily, the one nice thing is half the time the patrolmen aren't out on the highway when you're going, and so nobody picks you up. But it is a problem, and to now create a better exposure or a higher exposure before we've addressed how to resolve that issue does seem to me that it's probably inappropriate.
Senator Von Platern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The good senator from Natrona County, you brought up a great point that we actually spent several, probably 10 minutes discussing, and that was in regards to people that lived along those roads that they routinely closed. And as the good senator from Washakie said here, you easily can get these cards. You can call your district maintenance guy and or the highway patrol, give your issue, as in what the good senator from Albany County attempted to do. So all those are in place. But what the good senator from Glen Rock mentioned to us was that there was a death. And when those plows get out there trying to reopen the road, or when they're out finally, it's not too dangerous for them to go out there, they do believe that there's barriers set up, and they do believe that the traffic they will encounter is probably stationary. And unfortunately, in one incident there, it wasn't. In another incident in committee, the person that struck the plow was killed. So there's a lot of reasons. Every law we write, there needs to be some kind of exceptions to them generally. And there's special cases for everything. Every emergency will create a special case. But when you put up a law that for the minimal amount of money that is not going to deter anybody, yet is going to put your emergency services in danger and your snowplow Wyoming Department of Transportation employees, our employees, in danger, then I think you're setting up something that's not fair to them. It's going to eventually cost the state a whole lot of money. And I would ask you to pass this and move it forward, and we can talk about it on second.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I am interested to hear the card, because when I called the Transportation Department about the circumstance in our area, they didn't say a thing about any card. That's something new and different, or their own people don't know about it. Now, maybe we can solve our problem by getting the gate moved, but that causes certain other problems. And I just think we need to do a little more work in this area before we're ready for a fine of this magnitude.
Senator Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hesitate to rise because the time's getting late, and I do have a committee meeting after. But I'll go into ancient history. When I was down at the other end of the corridor and chaired a committee, the House passed a bill that said that the Highway Patrol or the YDOT maintenance crew may allow somebody through a barrier if in their estimation it will be a safe trip to wherever they're going, i.e. their house or their business and whatever. It passed down there 60-0, and it came up here in the Senate, in its infinite wisdom, substituted shall instead of may. The Highway Patrol or the Highway Maintenance crew shall allow anybody to go through who requests. And we had a conference committee. The Senate was adamant about shall, and we never had a meeting. And it died, of course. So maybe it's time that we resurrect that, giving the legal power to the Highway Patrol and to the YDOT maintenance departments to say, yes, Senator, you live up there. It's perfectly, there's not a snowdrop between here and your ranch. Go ahead. You're completely safe. And I do really think that it's time that we bring that back and we can mend it into here, unless it's a separate topic of its own. Give them that authority and let their common sense decide if people can go through.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Von Federn's motion that when a committee of the whole rises to report that it does so with a favorable motion on House Bill 22, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
House Bill 22 has passed the committee of the whole.
Our next bill for consideration is House Bill 9. Will the reading clerk please read it in?
House Bill 9, Campaign Finance Reporting, sponsored by the Corporations Committee, an act relating to campaign finance reporting. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation, Elections, and Political Subdivision. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Cooper, Larson, and Scott. Noes, Senator DeCaria, Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Case?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 9, Campaign Finance Reporting. There is a standing committee amendment, and I would ask that it be read in at this time.
Reading clerk, would you please read it?
House Bill 9, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy. Page 1, line 3.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the Standing Committee Amendment to House Bill 9, and I would yield to Senator Scott to tell us about this fine House bill.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I'll seek first to this bill is the campaign finance reporting, has to do with the campaign finance limitations. I will seek to explain the Standing Committee Amendment, but I do not see it and have not seen it, and ask, has it been distributed? It seems to have been. Yield to Senator Case.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, we just heard this bill this morning, so we'll pop it up here. But, Mr. Chairman, the Standing Committee Amendment does two things, Mr. Chairman. If you look at it from lines 10 through 20, it brings in another section of the statute, existing campaign law, and this has to do with employee payroll deductions when they're used for a PAC. Now, that PAC could be a labor PAC or it could be a management PAC, I suppose, Mr. Chairman. But the existing law is contained on line 18, where they 17 and 18, they affirmatively consent in writing to the contribution at least once in every calendar year. What that meant, if you were going to have payroll deduction for participation in a political action committee, you had to affirmatively consent every single calendar year. The testimony committee was, you know, why the employee sees this deduction on their check. They know that it's there. They can remove it at any time. Why do we require to do it every calendar year? So it's to remove the words at least once in every calendar year. So it just means now that there's a I'll read it in its entirety. No organization of any kind, as specified in subsection A of this section, shall solicit or obtain contributions for any purpose specified in subsection A of this section from an individual on an automatic basis, including but not limited to a payroll deduction plan or reverse checkoff method, unless the individual who is contributing affirmatively consents in writing to the contribution, period. Mr. Chairman, you'd see it on your payroll, and so you know that's there. You could stop it at any time. This was supported by kind of groups on both sides of the lobbying effort in the committee. Mr. Chairman, the other thing that the Standing Committee did was to return the bill to its form from the interim committee work. We took and removed some amendments that appeared at the west end of the building with respect to PAC contributions. We received the bill, PAC contributions in a single election were limited to $2,300. We put it back to the limits of the original bill of $3,500. And, Mr. Chairman, the total combination for a two-year election cycle we put at $7,000, which, again, was the original language of the bill. If you'll swing with me to page 5, lines 6 and 7, the last part of the Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, if you look in there, there's some language that was added down the hall that says, other than the candidate or the candidate's immediate family. That was not in the original interim committee bill. I'll read the entirety. Any additional receipts of $1,500 or more received from any one contributor, and then the new language, other than the candidate or the candidate's immediate family, shall be reported not later than the close of the following business day. So this deals with substantial contributions that you receive late in an election, and they have to be reported immediately, but there was an exception added for other than the candidate or the candidate's family. That was an exception from down the hall. We took that exception out. I think, let me scan this. I know we talked about changing the level of the exception in line 5, but I don't think we did anything about it, that $1,500. I don't think we touched that. I'm looking for a little guidance here. I don't see it in the amendment, so... that's it on the Standing Committee Amendment, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to yield back, or we could do the Standing Committee Amendment now. It's your pleasure.
We're on Standing Committee number 1. Any further discussion? Senator Vibout?
Chairman, I would ask that
that we divide the standing committee amendment to lines 1 through 20.
Senator Biebelt, Division 1 would be 1 through 20, and Division 2 would be the rest. And the chair finds that divisible. And which would you like to start with?
Mr. Chairman, the first division, lines 1 through 20. Mr. Chairman, I think we got to be really careful here, and I guess I would speak against this. You know, we're talking about campaign contributions that are deducted on a payroll, and if they do not at least look at those every calendar year, then it could be going on and on and on, and these people, you could say, well, yeah, they're supposed to look at it and understand it. And I think we had this debate years ago in the House about this particular issue, and I think we ought to just leave it like it is. I think these people ought to be able to say, I want it to be done this year, every calendar year. If you don't, it becomes automatic. They're not sure how it's being spent, where it's being spent, what it's being spent for, which party it may be spent for. I mean, I can't believe that everybody thought it was a good idea. I don't think it is a good idea. And I think we're going down a road that we've already debated many, many times, and now we're going back to once it's deducted, it's there forever, which is what I read into this, because obviously these employees are not going to be looking at it. So I think at least once in every calendar year gives them some protection that they need. So I would ask that the body defeat this portion of the Standing Committee Amendment.
We're on Division 1 of Standing Committee 1.
Senator DiCaria.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Chairman, the testimony in the committee, and I think you'd probably be surprised at who it was from a representative, a governmental relations representative for one of the large mineral producers in the state of Wyoming. And he brought the amendment forward, and the concern is that it becomes a paperwork nightmare for them in order to make this happen. I think he felt that his employees were bright enough to know that they've signed up for a payroll deduction and so that they would know that it was coming out of their check. He also testified that they get to see that every time they get a paycheck, they look at it and it's on there and it says that, you know, you're getting a deduction for going to this political contribution, so they get reminded once a month, and he just thought it was totally unnecessary that you make people sign up with this paperwork, which has to be filed away and has to be stored, and just becomes a burden on the employer as far as a paperwork requirement. So, Mr. Chairman, I would urge the body to pass this particular part of this, and let people make the decision and you know, have a little faith that they're smart enough to watch out for how they spend their money.
Further discussion. Senator Townsend.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I rise against this amendment. I've hired people for a long time, and lately in the last 10 years it's been very difficult to find somebody that even knows which side to sign the check on. So I have trouble with this amendment for just that reason. And I'm the bad guy when their wife finally finds out that we're deducting for these kind of things. I'm just afraid of these kinds of things getting started, and I can see the circumstances not good. Please defeat this amendment.
Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I was the no vote on this part of the amendment in committee for all the reasons that have been talked about. But I will say that one of the things we did here was that the federal rules are different. And with the federal rules, apparently you sign it once and that's good. So if you have a federal PAC, this doesn't apply. And there's apparently a discrepancy and it is generating considerable paperwork. It's not of great moment one way or the other in the passage of the bill. If you put this amendment in, then it'll be easier for the people who run PACs, and they're basically on both sides of the political aisle, big time in terms of the way those behave. But it, whatever we do doesn't have as much effect as we might, because of the discrepancy between the state and the federal laws.
Further discussion on Division 1. Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, I would just remind everybody this wasn't part of the interim committee's work. It was brought to the committee. There was agreement on both sides of the issue, And so, you know, I leave it to the body to decide. It's not like we worked all interim and this is what we came up with, okay? The rest of the bill is a lot more important than this section.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, you know, this is payroll deductions, but I don't think there's any law prohibiting anyone that wants to do an automatic deduction out of their checking account. And so if they want to do that, they can bypass this whole thing. And if there's paperwork problems or things that mount up in those regards, and I'd suggest that people that want the money go the next extra step and just ask them to take it out of their checking account. And then, we don't have to worry about this.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, I think you'd still have to worry about this because if you look at the language of the existing law, it says from an individual on an automatic basis, including but not limited to a payroll deduction plan. I think if it was an automatic basis, like the way I pay for my newspaper, that's kind of the same thing. But I would say that if it comes out of your checking account, you know, you see it every month and you have every month to make your decision about this.
Further discussion on Division 1. Seeing none. Ready for the question. All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion to adopt the standing, all those in favor of Division 1 of the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Chair is undecided. All those in favor of Division 1, please stand. All those opposed, please stand.
Burns is on the floor.
14 no.
The motion to adopt the Standing Committee, Division 1 of the Standing Committee, Amendment 1, has passed. We're on Division 2. Any comments? Further discussion? Senator Perkins?
I'd actually move, and I apologize to the body for this, but I actually move to create a third division. It should be lines 33 to 35.
Senator Perkins, one moment on that. Chair finds that divisible. That would be lines 21 through 32 will be Division 2. Lines 33 through 35 would be Division 3. We're on Division 2, Senator Perkins.
I have nothing with respect to Division 2.
Question on Division 2. All those in favor of Division 2, Standing Committee 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Division 2 has passed. Now we're on Division 3 of Standing Committee 1. And Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, as I read Division 3, what this is removing an amendment that the House put in that would exempt reporting of contributions from the candidate and their immediate family. The House put that in, and the Senate committee removed it and voted up, voted down. Again, it's not central to the bill.
Senator Perkins.
And that's exactly right, Mr. Chairman. Very quickly on this deal, I mean, ultimately the idea of having this immediate reporting is to know you're beholden to. I think your voters know that you're going to be beholden to yourself and your family, and it just seems, in some respects, since there are no limits on the amounts that immediate family and others can contribute, it just seems, in my mind, quite frankly, a little bit burdensome, and in some cases, all that not informative to individuals to know that you have contributed to your own campaign, or your parents did, or your brother or your kids did. So, to me, I think it's just an ill-conceived. Certainly people have the right to know if those coming from PACs or from other individuals who you may be beholding to, but your own family. I think that in large part is irrelevant to much of the discussion about anything.
Further discussion on Division 3. Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, I think we ought to look a little bit more carefully at this. You know, I can understand the issue with respect to the candidate. Remember, this section is about when you get money late in a race and you have to disclose it, I mean, we're moving towards more transparency in elections. If this bothers you here, you wait till you see the electronic filing, so it's coming your way. But that's not this bill. But, the general trend is towards more transparency. But we have raised the limits in this bill to allow people to exercise their free speech and ability to contribute. But this has to do, if you get a big contribution late in the race, you have to report it by the close of the following business day. Now, I guess I could see an exception possibly in Wyoming for the candidate putting some of their own money in at the end. You know, I've done it. I've put money in, need more radio at the end or whatever you have. But our immediate family, that's not always such a transparent thing in Wyoming. Because we're a small state, there are people on this that have served in the Senate that had immediate family that worked the lobby. I've seen it. And I had nothing against that. There was a governor one time that he was downstairs and his brother was up here. In fact, I think his brother might still be around up here. It's all about immediate family. And sometimes in Wyoming, your immediate family is also part of the business and the interest that I think we need to disclose in terms of election transparency. So I would caution about this.
On Division 3, any further discussion? Seeing none. The question being on Division 3 of Standing Committee 1 to House Bill 9. All in favor of Division 3, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no?
No.
Division 3 has failed. Back on the bill. Would anybody like to divide the bill? No, just kidding. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I would caution you not to invite that or we'll be here forever.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this bill came to us because there was objection in a particular local race where one individual used a PAC to go right around our campaign contribution limits and contribute a fairly large sum. I think it was over $11,000 in one particular local race. And it was perfectly legal, perfectly above board, and quite successful. And there was objection to that. It was duly reported and surfaced, and some of the interest groups felt that that was not a good idea, and the Joint Committee agreed with that. Mr. Chairman, the bill does two things. We've had a limitation in the law, and you can see it on page 2 at line 8 and 9 on individual contributions of $1,000. That has been that way at least to my personal knowledge since 1976, and I'm told it has probably been that way since 1974 and has not been updated for inflation. And so the Joint Committee decided to update that, to move it to $3,500 to be consistent. It probably should have been updated as we went along, but it hasn't been. So that's the provision there. Then the provision, as you see on page 3, starting at line 17, it increases the amounts for it puts a limitation on PAC contributions, which previously have been unlimited. And with the Standing Committee amendment, we went back to the original bill with limitations of $3,500 and then $7,000 on statewide races. And that puts a limitation that hasn't been there before on PAC contributions. Now, Mr. Chairman, I'll tell you, I'm one who has reservations on campaign finance limitations from natural persons in general. I think they're a threat to the First Amendment, and I think they have potentially perverse consequences, particularly in the larger statewide offices. The more you've got to go out and solicit campaign contributions, the more you get obsessed with the financing, and the less time to spend on issues and once they're in office on the duties of the office. and it's gotten us in trouble nationally. Having said that, these limitations, I think, for Wyoming are pretty reasonable. I think that maybe, frankly, I think it's a mistake to allow PACs at all, but I suppose that's not going to happen. So I think some kind of limitation on them is probably appropriate. It is a matter of judgment. I think that the changes we've made will make financing campaigns a little easier for some of the challengers, particularly in the statewide elections, because you won't have to solicit quite as many contributions, perhaps, if you can get a few larger ones. Frankly, I doubt that it'll have much impact at all on legislative races. We rarely get into that kind of rarefied atmosphere in terms of campaign finance. Mr. Chairman, that's the bill. There's some other plugging of some loopholes, the minor and the rest of the bill. Be happy to answer any questions and urge the Senate to adopt the bill.
Any further discussion on House Bill 9? Senator DeCaria.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I stand in opposition to this piece of legislation. Mr. Chairman, I voted against it in committee, and I was actually on the interim committee when this piece of legislation was put together. And Mr. Chairman, I can tell you that this piece of legislation kind of morphed into and had a life of its own. It changed from a solution to the problem the good senator from Natrona County talked about into one that took limits off of how much people can contribute in political campaigns and has become, I think, something that you probably really ought to take a close look at and approach with a sense of caution, just because I think it's gone past the point now that we're changing the way politics will be done in the state of Wyoming. You know, I would disagree on the reasons, you know, for with the senator from Natrona County, why his apprehensions and why he thought that some of it had some bad ideas, but I do think it does have some bad provisions in here, and I would urge you to seriously take a look at this before you vote yes on it. Thank you.
Further discussion on the bill? Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. Chairman, speaking on and for the bill, if you defeat the bill and stick with the existing law, what you've done is you've pushed campaign financing away from individual contributions, which would then be limited to the $1,000, and toward PAC contributions, which are unlimited. And, Mr. Chairman, I would urge the Senate that that is a policy mistake, that we're much better off having races financed by individuals. You can reason with individuals. You can explain to them why things were different. You needed to do something different than maybe they had wanted. In a way, you cannot reason with a PAC, which tends to be devoted to the particular special interest and not reasonable to deal with.
Further discussion on the bill?
Question.
Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Case motion when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 9, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no?
No.
House Bill 9 is passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 46. Will the reading clerk please read it in?
House Bill 46, Abuse of Animals, sponsored by Representative Berger, an act relating to abuse of animals. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Allman, Burns, Cole, Massey, and Mockler. Senator Burns, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I move that to do so with a favorable recommendation for House Bill 46, Abuse of Animals. And to give a further explanation of the bill, I ask that you call on the tall senator from Cheyenne.
Senator Peck.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I've handed out to everybody a current copy of existing state statute 6-3-203, the cruelty to animals statute. And if you would look at the part that I have circled and highlighted, subparagraph C, it lists that a person commits aggravated cruelty to animals if, and then there are several Roman numerals in there. Specifically, number two, owns, possesses, keeps, or trains fowls or dogs with the intent to allow the dog or fowl to engage in an exhibition of fighting with another dog or fowl. What House Bill 46 does is very, very simple. All it does is it takes that entire subsection C and makes it a felony. To do that, you have to delete one line in subparagraph E, and you have to add a line to subparagraph N. That is the bulk of this bill. Very, very simple. The question is, why do we create a felony out of that particular portion of the statute? Right now, it's my understanding that Idaho has just signed their felony law into place. So there are 49 of the 50 states that have a felony anti-dog fighting, anti-fowl fighting legislation. We do not want to encourage, I would not think, people to come to our state for this purpose. So I would ask that you give that some consideration, that we pass this bill for at least one of those reasons, that reason being one. Statistically, I cannot tell you that statistically we've had a major problem in our state with this type of activity. There is some evidence that it has occurred in various parts of the state, but it has not been a huge problem. Again, this legislation sends that signal that we don't want it to become a problem in our state. The last thing that I would mention to you is that on January 30th of this year, just a few days before we went into session, the two largest newspapers in our state, both of them did independent polls of our citizens, and there was an overwhelming majority in both of those surveys of our constituents that were asking us to pass legislation making this criminal act a felony and not a misdemeanor. And with that, I would ask for your favorable vote.
Any further comments? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, that to do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 46, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 46 is passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 78. Reading clerk, please read.
House Bill 78, County Road Fund, sponsored by Representative Semlich, and Act Relating to Highways. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Geis, Hastert, Johnson, Landon Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Hastert?
Mr. Chairman, I make a motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 78. And for explanation of the bill, I would have you call on Senator Cooper.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Fellow Senators, this bill is, House Bill 78 is all about the County Road Fund. Now, the County Road Fund has been in existence for many, many years. As a matter of fact, some of you may recall that it used to be called the State County Farm to Market Road Fund. It's been in existence for a whole long time, a whole lot of time, I should say. Mr. Chairman, this bill does not attempt to add any funding or anything to that road fund. It's just merely changing the way that the county commissioners can use the money for road maintenance. Right now, the fund is limited to $100,000 worth of maintenance money that the commissioners can use to maintain these county roads with. And as you well know, $100,000 a day to try to maintain a road doesn't get you very far. And this just gives them a little flexibility on being able to use some more of that money to actually maintain the roads as well as construct them. Keep in mind that there still is a $50,000 bid limit on this, so that anything that costs more than $50,000, the commissioners have to bid out to contract. On the bill itself, going through the bill, on page 1, section A there at the bottom of page 1 deals with the talks about the establishment of the Road Construction Fund, which is a separate maintenance and construction fund that is already established in the counties. This is just adding the word maintenance so that fund will have, of course, a proper name and be able to be describe its use better. And then going on through page 2, as you can see, we've added the word maintenance in several places there. And it also talks on that page about competitive bidding and the $50,000 that are required. It also talks about a Wyoming County Road Standards Committee that is in existence. It's, I believe, two county engineers, two commissioners, two contract people from the Contractors Association, and then a person at large. It's seven people. And they actually set, they have a book about 3 inches thick that describes how the standards are for the use of this money for maintenance as well as construction. And that's been in existence for several years. Section C deals with the gasoline license taxes, where this money comes from, and we're not changing any of that at all. We just added the word maintenance in there, so we'll cover construction and maintenance. Section G over on page 3 talks again about this, the standards committee, and also adds the word construction and maintenance on that, as you can see. On section H also of that page, that's the section that deals with emergencies for either now construction or maintenance purposes. And then down at the bottom of page 3, it deals with 3914801, which is the severance tax distribution, which is how this is already in statute, and we're and this is how this money, some of the funds come from the gasoline tax, and some of it comes from the severance tax, and that's the way it is in statute currently. We're not changing anything there. And it just adds the word maintenance to that particular statute. And in section 2 there on page 4, the repealer, the reason that needs to be repealed because that deals with the $100,000 limit on being able to use $100,000 limit for maintenance only. And so we had to take that out in order to make it conform to the rest of the bill. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for questions.
Further discussion on House Bill 78? Question. Seeing none, question. All those in favor of Senator Hastert's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, that to do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 78, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 78 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Mr. President.
Good job.
Good bill.
That kept me going a little bit.
divide. Would the reading clerk please read the Committee of the Whole report?
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. House Bill 111, do pass. House Bill 81, do pass. House Bill 55, do pass, amended. House Bill 89, do pass, amended. House Bill 38, failed to pass the Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. House Bill 30, do pass, amended. House Bill 36, do pass, amended. House Bill 22, do pass. House Bill 9, do pass, amended. House Bill 46, do pass. House Bill 78, do pass. Senator Von Fladern, Chairman.
Senator Von Fladern. Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
The motion is to adopt the Committee of the Whole report. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The report has been adopted. Messages from the House.
February the 28th, 2008, from the House of Representatives, message number 6. Mr. President, the House has completed consideration of the budget bill, Senate File 1. Pursuant to Joint Rule 14-1, Senate File 1 is referred directly to a conference committee of 5 members from each House to meet and report recommended amendments for final consideration by both Houses with respect to both budget bills, Senate File 1, House Bill 1, and the amendments thereto. Sincerely, Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. February the 28th, 2008, from the House of Representatives. Message number 195, conferees appointed. Joint Conference Committee number 1, Mr. President. The Speaker appointed House conferees to meet with a like committee number 1 from the Senate on amendments to Senate File 1. The House conferees are Representative Flip, Chairman, Representative Berger, Jorgensen, Lubnow, and Shepperson. Patricia Benson, House Chief Clerk. You have these back.
Reports from standing committees.
February the 26th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, excuse me, to whom was referred House Bill 54, reports back with the favor, with the recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Anderson, Case, Jennings, Mockler, and Ross, Senator Anderson, Chairman. February the 26th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 33, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, Jennings, Mockler, and Ross, no, Senator Case, Senator Anderson, Chairman. February the 28th, 2008, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 91, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, Case, Mockler, and Ross. No, Senator Jennings, Senator Anderson, Chairman.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. President. House Bill 33, Engrossed Veterans Property Tax Exemption, does contain an appropriation, and I would ask that it be re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations.
Hearing no objection, so ordered. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears this desk.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate adjourn until 10 a.m. on Wednesday, February 27.
Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land and Water Resources, will meet in about 10 minutes to take up House Bill 74, Veterinary Loan Repayment Program, House Bill 85, Brucellosis Testing Program, and House Bill 88, Omnibus Water Bill Planning.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in the regular committee room. House Bill 82, Trauma Care Services. House Bill 52, Engrossed Developmental Programs, Cost-Based Reimbursements. House Bill 98, Speech Pathologist Licensing. House Bill 13, Psychologist Licensure to the extent time permits.
Senator Cole.
Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock in S11 to hear House Bill 113, School Finance, Minimum Teacher Resources, House Bill 134, School District Community and Liability Insurance, and House Bill 77, Tuition, Dependents of Disabled Firefighters and EMTs, 2.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet tomorrow, 20 minutes after the noon recess in S18. This is a revised schedule, so to consider House Bill 48, Engrossed, State Loan and Investment Board Loans, House Bill 111, Engrossed, Wyoming Homemade Products, and House Joint Resolution 10, Radio Stations.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet tomorrow morning, Wednesday, February 27th at 8 a.m. to consider the following bills: House Bill 97, Engrossed Juvenile Hearings Timeliness; House Bill 44 engrossed, Crime Victims Compensation, House Bill 57 engrossed, Emergency Powers, Right to Bear Arms, and if time permits, House Joint Resolution Number 1, Initiative and Referendum Requirements.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. Committee Number 2, Appropriations, will meet upon adjournment to consider carbon capture and sequestration in House Bill 90. Then the committee will meet tomorrow at 1 p.m. to consider the following bills: House Bill 17 engrossed, Community College Commission's duties, and House Bill 12 engrossed, Veterans Mental Health Appropriations. Mr. President, both of those are in Senate Room 13, and the conference committee will start tomorrow at the call of the chairman's, but we anticipate starting at 8 a.m.
Chairman Nicholas, the conference committee is going to meet in S13, or?
I think we'll probably meet in, we kind of like our appropriations rooms. Well, how about in our appropriations committee room, Mr. President?
Well, I was just thinking if the House committee wants to sit on the ledge outside the window and negotiate, it's always a good place to start.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea, but we kind of like our chairs. We'll start in the 204.
Okay, thank you. Senator Von Flatron.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 8, Transportation, Highway, and Military Affairs, will meet tomorrow evening, Wednesday, February 27th, upon adjournment. House Bill 73, DUI penalties. House Bill 137, Castle Doctrine.
Further announcements, Senator Case.
Mr. President, even though it's late, we're still going to have a brief meeting. I hope it's brief, of the Corporations Committee to continue our discussion of House Bill 9. It's sort of a warm-up to the telecommunications reception that's tonight at the Hitchin Post. So,
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, the previous announcement, it wasn't House Bill 9. That's the one that went through general file. It's the telecommunications bill.
The number?
109. House Bill 109.
House Bill 109.
Thank you.
Okay, House Bill 109. Further announcements? The motion is that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The Senate is adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.